Good evening, everybody. It's roll time here with the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Committee. We don't quite have a quorum, so we're going to get started right away. We'll come back to the minutes and approve our previous minutes from a prior meeting. So I think we'll just get started right away on our solar overview tonight. We're going to start with our testifiers. Bob Eloff, Research Development Analyst, just talking about our 2013 legislature and kind of bring us up to speed, if you would, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'd like to do is to give a brief overview of the legislation that was passed in 2013 regarding solar energy, and there are five pieces of legislation that I want to speak to. One is the solar energy standard. Second is the value of solar rate. Third is Xcel's solar incentive. Fourth is Xcel's community solar garden program. And finally, the Made in Minnesota solar incentives. I'll give a brief overview of the legislation and also, to the extent I'm aware, maybe a little bit of what has happened in terms of implementation in the past 18 months since these provisions were enacted. The first thing I wanted to say is that everything I talk about tonight will, as the legislation was written, applies to public utilities only. Electric co-ops and municipal utilities are not required to do anything under the legislation that I'll be speaking about tonight. So I'd like to start first with the solar energy standard, which requires that in the year 2020, 1.5% of the retail sales of public utilities come from solar facilities. That's a mandatory requirement. There's also a goal that was established in the legislation of 10% by 2030, but the latter is just a goal. And this 1.5% is in addition to the existing renewable energy standard. And there is no double counting allowed, so that while solar energy could apply to that renewable energy standard, it cannot also apply to this new solar energy standard. They are counted separately. Another thing that was done under that law is that it's based on total retail sales, but there were exclusions from the way total retail sales are to be calculated for the purposes of determining whether or not the 1.5% standard has been met. The legislature indicated that certain industries, including paper mills, sawmills, wood products industries, and oriented strand board manufacturers, were to be excluded from the total retail sales, and also to be excluded from any costs that were required to be placed into rates to meet the solar energy standard. In November 2014, in a PUC order, the commission listed about 26 different more finely grained industries that come under those that I mentioned before. And I should also say that the size of the exclusions vary greatly by utility. For example, Xcel Energy, as measured, in, this is measured in 2012 sales, approximately 2.1% of Xcel sales were in those excluded categories. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, Minnesota Power, 70% of its 2012 sales were in categories that are excluded from being included in total retail sales under the solar energy standard. The upshot of that is that instead of a 1.5% standard, once you make those exclusions, we'll really end up with about a 1.25% standard in 2020. The law also specified that 10% of the standard must be met by systems with a capacity of 20 kilowatts or less. The next thing I'd like to talk about we call the value of solar rate. And the first thing I'll say is that the legislation did not name a rate. It instead came up with a process by which the Department of Commerce was charged to develop a methodology as to how to calculate the value of solar rate. And that calculation or the elements that must be included in that calculation, which was to be further approved by the Public Utilities Commission, but any actual rate, meaning any actual tariff or cost that will be charged to customers is calculated by individual utilities themselves based on this approved methodology. I think the concept behind the value of solar rate is that solar energy being generated on site avoids other costs that utilities normally face when they're generating utility from a centralized facility. Because it's on site, there are essentially no distribution costs or transmission costs, also no fuel costs. So the goal here was to determine what those cost savings were, and in essence, those are of value to the utility because otherwise they would have to pay those costs to generate the same amount of energy in their centralized facilities. The language that's actually used in the legislation defines it as the value to the utility, its customers, and society for operating distributed solar photovoltaic resources. It takes a very broad view of that. And this is this value of solar rate is to be applied instead of the retail or avoided cost rate under net metering, which we discussed last week. The legislation says various things about what this tariff requires. First, it has to allow fixed customer costs to be required. I know this is an important issue that we've discussed before in terms of not allowing any cross-subsidization from customers who don't have solar energy to those that do. The tariff must allow credits to be carried forward for additional energy, more for the energy that's produced that is not consumed by the generator. And those credits are credited against future charges. And at the end of 12 months, any balance is eliminated. The legislation also says there can be no standby charges under a value of solar rate. And it says the rate itself must be recalculated every year to account for new developments. The legislation also says that contracts that are paid under the solar rate must have a term of at least 20 years, and that the rate itself cannot be lower than the retail rate for the first 3 years that the rate has been instituted at a utility. And finally, the owner is paid the same value of solar rate for the term of the contract. That rate doesn't change for the individual owner. So the Department of Commerce embarked on a long process to develop a methodology for the value of solar rate, in which a large number of stakeholders were involved. And the legislation required them to complete that methodology in January 2014. And among the avoided costs that the Department of Commerce included in its methodology were some of the ones I've already mentioned: fuel costs, which solar facilities don't face, plant operation and maintenance costs, both fixed and variable, generation capacity costs, something called reserve capacity costs, transmission capacity costs, distribution costs, and finally, environmental costs are also part of value of solar rate. And in March 2014, the Public Utilities Commission approved the methodology that the Department of Commerce arrived at for calculating a value of solar rate. And I believe that I'll be talking a few minutes later about the Excel's Community Solar Garden Program, under which the Commission actually required Excel to calculate a value of solar rate. I think to this point, no utility has actually offered a tariff based on this rate to the Public Utilities Commission. I want to move on now and talk about Xcel Solar Incentive, which was also part of the 2013 legislation. It requires the utility to use $5 million annually for a period of 5 years coming from its Renewable Development Fund account. And these incentives are to be used, again, for solar projects that are 20 kilowatts or less in capacity. And those facilities that are obtaining this incentive can not be cannot be sized at more than 120% of the annual consumption of that facility or residence. The incentive is to be paid for 10 years, and it's a performance-based incentive, which means it's paid per kilowatt hour that's actually generated. And the incentive has been set by Excel at 8 cents a kilowatt hour, And in 2015, they have indicated that 4.5 megawatts of capacity are available under that incentive for this coming year. Next, I'd like to speak about Xcel's Community Solar Garden Program, which I think the concept behind this is that upfront costs of solar facilities are often a barrier for residences or even commercial facilities to implement them. And sometimes residents are just at the wrong location. There's not sufficient sunshine. And this is a way that all residences and commercial facilities can partake of solar energy. Solar garden can be either rooftop or ground mounted, and the legislation required Xcel to file a plan with the Public Utilities Commission by October 2013. It allowed other utilities to do so. A community solar garden essentially is a facility that's can be owned by either the utility or another kind of entity. It must be located in the utility's service territory. Its capacity is limited to 1 megawatt. And what it does is sell subscriptions to residential or commercial facilities in that area that must be at least 200 watts in capacity, and again, can't exceed 120% of the average customer's consumption. And the legislation further specified that each community solar garden must have at least 5 subscribers. The utility must buy all the excess energy that's generated at either the value of solar rate or the retail rate. And in April 2014, the commission, in an order, had decided essentially that the retail rate, which it computed at about 12 cents a kilowatt hour, was too low to allow for the proper financing of community solar gardens, that 15 cents was the minimum needed. And the commission said Xcel must offer to pay an additional 2 cents for the renewable energy credits that are associated with solar energy. 2 cents for small community solar gardens and 3 cents for larger ones. As I said, it was under that docket that Xcel computed a value of service rate originally at 11.4 cents per kilowatt hour, but based on comments received by the Department of Commerce and others, that was eventually lowered to 9.4 cents a kilowatt hour. And finally, I'd like to talk about the Made in Minnesota solar incentives, which are both for photovoltaic solar and also for solar thermal facilities. $15 million total for both of those, $14.75 million for photovoltaics, $250,000 a year for solar thermal. And this is $15 million per year for 10 years. The money came from two places. One, it came from 5% of the conservation improvement program spending that utilities are required to make. Again, this applies only to public utilities, so that 5% collectively amounts to, I think, about $3 or $4 million. The balance of the $15 million came again from Xcel's Renewable Development Fund. The Department of Commerce was charged with determining exactly which modules qualified under this legislation for those incentives in terms of not only being manufactured in Minnesota, but also the technical specifications that were included in the law. And it's the Department of Commerce which certifies that modules are eligible to receive the incentive. The Department of Commerce was also charged with setting the actual incentive itself, which again was supposed to be performance-based, based on the kilowatt hours produced by the facility, and the incentive is to be paid for 10 years. The incentives are to go to facilities that are under 40 kilowatts in capacity and are supposed to be split evenly between residential and commercial users. The Commerce Commissioner is also instructed to try to award incentives geographically to approximate the utility contributions from those SIP funds that I mentioned earlier. The department has set for, I believe, for 2015, the residential incentive at between 25 and 28 cents, depending on which company is producing which modules, and the commercial subsidy at 13 to 35 cents per kilowatt hour produced. And finally, the solar thermal Made in Minnesota incentive program is funded by a portion of that money that I described earlier. It's $250,000 a year for 10 years. The residential incentive is to be the lesser of 25% of the installed cost of the system, or $2,500. The commercial incentive is, again, 25% of the installed cost, or $25,000. And the Department of Commerce has been directed under the legislation to allocate, to the extent sufficient applications are forwarded to them, 50% of the incentive to heating water and 50% to heating air. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my summary.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Eloff. That was a great overview on this. I'm going to ask for any questions for Mr. Eloff first before we go to our first testifier, and then we'll get a quick motion on the minutes in just a minute now that we have a quorum. So any questions for Bob at this point? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, Mr. Chair, I think is for Mr. Eloff. But I'd like you to clarify for me. We're looking on the back side of your two-page handout here where it talks about payments that run for 10 years and are to be split evenly between the residential and commercial properties. Do I conclude correctly that that is the owners of the residential and commercial properties that allocated to install solar devices with a capacity not greater than 40 kilowatts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, yes, that's correct.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, quick follow-up.
Yes, go ahead.
Quick follow-up would be, how do you split evenly? I mean, where is the, tell me how that mathematical calculation might work.
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, I think maybe you're asking for the definition between those two different categories of facilities. The legislation really leaves that in the hands of the Department of Commerce to determine that, although there are definitions of residences in the statute that I think would apply.
Mr. Simonson.
And Mr. Chair, is I don't know if anybody's here from the Department of Commerce or not, but that would be a question going forward that I will try not to lose sight of.
Thank you, Representative. Okay. Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned in your presentation that there were specific industries that were exempt. Do you? This is a I wasn't at the meeting question. What was, do you remember what predicated why an industry would be exempt from this requirement? Was there a discussion about that?
Mr. Eloff.
Mr. Chair, I'm uncomfortable talking about legislative intent. I see Representative Portman raising her hand there. She may have a better answer for this than I could give.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunin, I drafted that provision. It's modeled on what they did in Germany, which is to exempt energy-intensive industries so as not to create a competitive disadvantage for companies within the German country in competing in the European markets. So whereas a BMW was excluded, we excluded our mining and our paper mills. If you look at your average business, energy is not a substantial portion. Well, it's a substantial portion, but it's not overwhelmingly substantial. But if you look at a paper mill or a mining operation, the cost of energy relative to the other costs of their inputs is very substantial, and we didn't want to send any industries out of the state of Minnesota.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative. So if there were other businesses that demonstrated a same usage level, would they have access to that same exemption then?
Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lunin, no, only the ones listed in statute would qualify.
Representative Lunin.
Question answered.
All right. Representative Matisa. That's up. My glasses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Believe me, I've heard it all.
Thank you. My apologies.
I just wanted to comment and give you a little example of why that kind of came about. I have a company in my district called Mintac. We're the largest taconite producing facility in the domestic United States, and we are the largest power consumer in the state for any business. And so our power bill at that's one of our plants at Mintac is $10 million a month. And so to put that in perspective, that's kind of why we looked at the German model.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eliff, when you talked about the funding of the some of the solar incentives, you mentioned the 5% SIP spending requirement that that utilities are required to spend, but my understanding was that there wasn't a minimum spending requirement for utilities, that it was actually a performance mandate. Can you explain to me how that works?
Mr. Chair, yep. Representative Garofalo, you're correct about the performance requirement, but the spending requirement still happens to be on the books, and it's that number that's used in making the calculation.
Understood. Thank you.
Yep. No further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Eliff. We do have a quorum now. The chair wants to recognize that the quorum is present, and I see Representative Garofalo would like to introduce the minutes from our meeting back in Wilmer on February 9th. Is there any questions or additions to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No, I'm kidding.
Thanks.
Got to give you a hard time.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Mitza. Yeah, I'll get that right. All right. Thank you. What we'll do is, Mr. Larson, if Mr. Larson is ready to come to join us at the front.
No, it's a bear. Who's that? There we go. Right. Mm-hmm. Floating around. Well. Matiza. What's that?
And good evening. If you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good evening. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Doug Larson with Dakota Electric Association.
All right. Go ahead. Please proceed.
Really, the presentation I'm giving this evening is, think of it as a continuation of your meeting last Wednesday, February 4th, where you were looking at net metering. So that's the context where this really fits in. It's not necessarily meant to be included as a discussion of solar energy issues specifically.
Thank you very much, Mr. Larson, too. I just wanted to recognize that we didn't have quite enough time to finish at our last meeting back in here. So thank you for rejoining us this evening.
Thank you. I just don't want anyone to misinterpret that this is not intended to be just directed at solar.
Not at all. Thank you again.
So what we've done, the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, a couple of years ago, a group of the distribution cooperatives and G&Ts started looking more, taking a harder look at net metering and the impact on the cooperatives. So what we did is we've conducted an analysis of the cost impact on our members as more members would install qualifying facilities or distributed generation. So you'll see the purpose of this study was to identify the economic impact, or what we've called shifted costs, to our non-QF members when customers participate in net metering. And our intent, what we did is we developed an analysis and a template. All the cooperatives in the state complete a financial form each year, financial reporting form. So we were able to use that consistent financial reporting document, and we created an analysis template so each cooperative in the state could plug in their individual numbers into this template, which would include some of the provisions in their individual rate design. So we know that not all the utilities have the same monthly charge, for example. So difference in the monthly charges will impact the shifted costs for a utility. I should explain what we mean by shifted costs are the costs of a utility that don't go away when a customer generates their own energy. And I think you heard this last Wednesday with Mr. Brown and Ms. Hamm. In their presentations, they took a look at the utility costs, what some of the cost categories or components were. And then they also, Ms. Hamm in particular, she in one of her slides looked at the rate design of utilities and where we recover different types of costs.
Excuse me, Mr. Larson, what does QF stand for?
Oh, a QF is a qualifying facility. So under the provisions of Minnesota statute, and as it relates particularly to electric cooperatives, think of it as the smaller wind installations or solar installations that a residential customer or business might have.
Thank you.
This pie chart here demonstrates or shows what the different variable and fixed costs are for a typical cooperative in the state. I should point out these are not Dakota Electric's numbers. They're of a more representative distribution cooperative. And you can see on the right hand of the slide here, those represent the various distribution cooperative costs. And really, all of those costs are fixed. When we install our distribution infrastructure and operate the system, a qualifying facility, their operation really doesn't change what our fixed costs are. We still need to install the same infrastructure at the customer site and close to the site. And you'll see in a slide later, even as we move upstream in our system towards the substations, because of the intermittent nature of a qualifying facility, we still need to plan and build our system to be capable of providing service to those customers when their distributed generation is not operating. On the left side of the screen here, it shows what the wholesale power components are. The lower quadrant are the fixed cost components for the generation and transmission cooperative. The upper left quadrant are the variable components, and that's basically the energy or fuel costs. We know when a distributed generation operates, we don't need to generate energy, so we save on those fuel costs. That roughly one quarter in this picture, those are the costs that we don't incur when someone generates their own energy. The rest of that, this pie chart, are costs that we continue to incur. So if a utility receives no compensation from customers with qualifying facilities, as I mentioned, we still have to have that same infrastructure in place ready to provide them with service when their facility isn't operating. Yet, you know, these costs that we have are embedded in our average residential energy rate. Especially in our case, Dakota Electric, we're the only rate-regulated electric cooperative in the state. As a result, our monthly fixed charge tends to be on the lower side, similar to what Xcel Energy has. By that, I mean, and we're in the midst right now of a rate case at the Public Utilities Commission. Right now, our monthly residential fixed charge is $8, and yet if you look at our cost of service study, the consumer cost for our average residential customer is closer to $23. So you can think of that difference. In essence, the difference between $8 and $23, that's embedded in our energy charge, and we have to recover those costs through that charge. So when someone installs their own generation, we don't collect that revenue and get shifted to everyone else. The predominant qualifying facilities, certainly that we serve, are solar and wind, and we know those are intermittent and they're non-dispatchable. By that I mean they're generating when the wind is blowing and when the sun is shining. And I thought I would include a couple of graphs here. Just in these, again, these are solar, but don't take this as just solar. I wanted to demonstrate for you what intermittent means in a graph. This is actual output from a solar installation on a clear day. And you can see, for those of you that have seen solar production curves, this graph looks pretty familiar. The energy starts ramping up probably around mid-morning, reaches a peak around midday, and then starts to tail off. And by the evening hours, there isn't much production. So this is what a facility looks like on a clear day. Here's what that same facility looks like on a day with intermittent clouds. So it wasn't a cloudy day, but, you know, think of a nice blue sky and you've got those nice white puffy clouds kind of going by. That's the impact of those white puffy clouds on the production of the solar facility. And this really, for me, demonstrates the point of the intermittent nature of a facility and the fact that we have to provide or have facilities in place capable of meeting this customer's need even when those spikes are happening and the clouds are going over. So that's the distribution side. When we look at the generation side, there are shifted costs there as well. Although there's a slight nuance here, in the short term, all we do have our current generation is sufficient to meet our customers' present needs. So we've got all the generating resources, everything is built. As we tend to get customers generating their own energy, those costs don't go away. You can't scale back a large generating plant by small increments. You've already got those capital costs there. You need to be recovering that. So I look at that in probably the next 10 to 15 years. Certainly, Great River Energy, our wholesale power supplier, isn't looking at a need for new generating resources. However, when you get beyond that point, when you're looking at a point in the future where a utility needs new generation, then there may be opportunities to reduce the size or the type of generation that would be required. So, for example, you may reduce the need for some baseload generation, but conversely, you may increase the need for some peaking generation, as an example. So getting to the analysis that we did, looking at the bill impacts of net metering, we looked at three specific scenarios. In the first scenario, what we looked at was generation that was sized to load. So for the average residential customer on the distribution system, if they installed either solar or wind, and the energy production exactly matched their load. In scenario two, right now for cooperatives, the net metering applies up to 40 kW. And there are a number of cooperatives that have instances where residential customers or actually no customer, someone has installed a 39.9 kW wind generator, and really the only load at the site is the wind generator. So you've got generation happening without load. Under our current statute that applies to us, we must purchase that at the retail rate. So that was our scenario two. What happens when someone installs a generation right up to that allowable threshold, but their actual load at the site is significantly less than that? Then scenario three looked at that kind of a modification of scenario two. What if that same customer installs the 39.9 kW distributed generation, but instead of us paying the average retail rate under current statute, what happens if we paid the MISO avoided cost rate? Now, for those of you that were worried about this, I did not include all the analysis. Let's just skip to the results slide. And this shows what the bill impact would be as increasing numbers of residential customers on a system would install generation under those different scenarios. You can see looking across at the line of, let's just start at 5%. If 5% of the residential customers participated and they built generation just to match load, we would see an increase in rates for everyone else of about 4%. So it's close to a one-to-one relationship, which is what you would expect. Under scenario two, that increase is much more severe. It's now 11%. When we get to scenario three, where now we're paying for the excess at the MISO cost, it actually drops right back to what scenario one's results are. So it's really no different than if someone installed generation just to serve their own load. The reason for that is the excess that we're buying, the cost of that is no different than the cost of energy we're buying in the wholesale market anyway. Our concern is as we start to move towards increasing penetration of qualifying facilities, what the bill impact would be on all other residential members. And you can see how that can start to be rather dramatic.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Now, we actually have a question from one of our committee members, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm still getting familiar with some of your terms here. Back on 5, when you were talking about the MISO avoided cost, the cost is avoided to whom? Avoided to the company?
Representative, what we mean by that is what we would pay our retail member is what we would pay for wholesale power in the MISO market. So we're treating the avoided cost, in essence, is the cost of energy we're buying in the wholesale market anyway. Is that...
Representative Clark.
And you would, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you would be... the next chart shows that brings it down to... brings it down to the 4%. You know, all the way across, I guess. I'm not sure I still understand. So the cost that's avoided is the cost to you. Avoided cost to
right.
you.
Right. What we're really seeing in that scenario three is, in many respects, the utility is indifferent because we can either buy that energy in the wholesale market at the price in the MISO market, or if we pay that same price to our member for the energy they generate. It doesn't matter if it came from that qualifying facility or the wholesale market. It's the energy is priced at the same level.
Representative Clark?
Another question. You were talking earlier about the fixed capital cost. What about the operating cost? When you're not providing that energy to the residential customer because they're generating their own, I think what I understand about what you're avoiding is your fixed capital cost, but what about the operating costs? It seems to me like you'd have less operating costs that you'd be saving that. So I'm not sure why. Do you count
Mr.
that
Larson.
In some way?
I'm sorry.
You understand my question?
Yes, Representative, that is included in that variable cost component. So that one quarter of the pie where we included variable, that's fuel cost as well as variable operating and maintenance costs are all included in that wholesale piece.
Representative Clark.
Maybe I'm missing something. But when you're not providing the energy to the residential customer and they're generating it themselves, mm-hmm. that's a savings to that customer, to that family. And I'm trying to figure out how you put that into your formula as a cost to you.
Representative, that... what we're looking at here are the costs that the utilities incur to provide service. This analysis doesn't look at, for that individual homeowner, what the economics are for them of owning their qualifying facility versus purchasing energy from us.
Right, I think I understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to understand why the capital costs are the same. But it seems to me, since you're not... you're calling it a variable cost, but it's really a savings to the company. You're not having to provide that energy to the customer. It's really a savings to the company rather than a cost to the company, right?
Mr. Larson.
The savings that we incur are the variable energy costs and O&M associated with that. As I mentioned earlier, for us to provide service to these customers, we still have to have the same infrastructure. We have to have all of that in place, so we're incurring those capital costs. We're really not saving those costs at all.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm not asking the question clearly enough, but I'm trying to make a distinction between, yes, you have the ongoing capital costs, but if you're not providing the energy, you're actually saving some operating costs, it seems to me. So I don't know why that's not part of the formula, unless I'm missing something.
Mr. Chairman, can
maybe somebody else can help me.
Representative Gruffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Clark, first of all, when they use the term avoided cost, what they're saying is the cost of the fuel, right? So let's say you got a natural gas plant or you have a coal-fired power plant. When you have a distributed generation facility, that fuel doesn't need to be purchased. So that is the cost that's excluded. So that's what the term avoided cost. I'm summarizing a more complex issue, but that's the savings to the utility, in this case to the ratepayers. When they're talking about capital costs, regardless of what the distributed generation facility does, they have to have the same generation available and on-site, so there is no savings to the ratepayers from the generation side, from the utility's perspective, because it has to be there. In addition, to the customer, they still have the same wire connecting into their house on their building that still exists. The utility still has to maintain it. Now, there's a much more complicated assessment of, you know, what is that value in terms of, are we able to delay, for example, if there's enough distributed generation in one area, are there infrastructure costs that don't have to occur? That's where Mr. Eloff was getting into the value of solar conversation. But there's just different ways of calculating what the value is of the distributed generation the customer has. Avoided cost is one term, and they mapped out other scenarios, the wholesale power market and MISO. And so they're just presenting us that information in a couple different ways of looking at it.
I'll keep listening. Thank you, Mr.
Does that help, Ms. Does that help, Representative?
A little. I still have to learn something more.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Larson, please continue. Oh, I'm sorry. No, Representative Hortman has a question.
Just a quick question. What percent of your residential customers today have a qualifying facility?
For us, it's
yes.
very
Mr.
small
Larson.
At Dakota Electric.
So like a percent, less than a percent?
Oh, it's. I can tell you the number because I just filed the report today. It's 40. 40 consumers have qualifying facilities.
So if you were to translate in that into a percentage, would you say less than a percent?
Mr. Larson.
Yes, absolutely, Representative Hartman. It's very small.
Thanks.
I think that the concern or the issue we have, and here let me just go to the last slide, gets to our findings in rate design. Kind of the point that we want to make is we need to be looking at rate designs that are properly recovering the costs of these qualifying facilities so we're not shifting these costs to other consumers. And it's if I could draw a parallel, there are a number of different rate offerings that we have at Dakota Electric where we do that. For a number of years, we've been involved with load management programs where people can consume energy off-peak and it saves. We more recently implemented an electric vehicle rate, which I know you're familiar with. And we did that. If you were to ask me how many electric vehicles we have right now, you know of at least one, but I can tell you the last I saw, we had over 50 vehicles. And someone might ask, with a utility with 100,000 members, why are you designing a rate where right now there are only 50 cars? And I think our answer there, and the same for the qualifying facilities, is it's a chance for us to get ahead of an issue that may develop. When we looked at the electric vehicles, that was important to us because in our area we thought there's the potential for a number of electric vehicles to be on our system. And I can recall the day I sat down and penciled out what the cost impact would be on the cooperative, and I was quite startled. If someone has an electric vehicle and they use that and they charge it on peak, there are significant costs that we would incur that could shift it to everyone else. So because of that, we offered our time of use electric vehicle rate in addition to the storage rate that we had, so customers have options. It's the same analogy here when we're looking at qualifying facilities. We're more forward looking here and we're concerned as the price of solar starts to drop, especially, and we start seeing potentially hundreds, we don't want to be caught at some point in the future trying to take care of the issue then.
Representative Hortman, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Larson, so in the sort of a converse situation, say you had a new business locate in your service territory a data storage site or something that requires a lot of energy, and you had to add new generation to your portfolio. What mechanisms do you have in place to make sure that those costs aren't shifted to the existing residential market? Because they don't need the new generation. It's the business that would.
Mr. Larson.
What? I think that it's kind of site-specific looking at, you mentioned a data center. That's a unique load in and of itself. The rate design, I can tell you, for a data center would look much different, especially large data centers, than probably any other customer we have on our system. But like any other customers, well, I recall back in the days when we actually had load growth, our last highest annual energy sales happened in 2007. We haven't exceeded that since. Since 2007, our energy sales have been flat. But at some point, to your question, when load growth occurs, and hopefully it will occur, we'll have residential and other businesses. They all contribute to that. And then as a pool, everyone shares in those increasing costs.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Larson, what I'm hearing you say is there isn't a mechanism in place to make sure that in that situation that homeowners wouldn't contribute to the cost of the new generation.
Mr. Larson.
That's correct. There's not a segregation of pricing that would charge new or draw a line and say new customers as of this date are going to pay more compared to old customers or prior customers.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, I asked the question to demonstrate that the idea of cross-subsidy is a very complex question. And while some may look at a solar installation on a residential property as employing some sort of a cost shift because of the system. In reality, we do that every day in the electricity market in lots of different ways. And so if we're going to start getting highly specific about who's causing what burden on the system, I think at the legislature, all we would do would be regulating energy policy.
Thank you. We're going to try to wrap up our testimony here. And, Representative Lunan, you have a quick follow-up?
Well, it's going to be quick now.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lutz, would it be fair to say that the paying at the MISO rate, what that's doing is the utility is going to treat that that owner of the solar facility as any other location they would buy energy from? So the relationship, the rates, everything would be the same. It would also put that homeowner in a situation, or whoever's generating it, in a situation where their buyer, the utility, would be just as if they were going out competing with any other utility. So it's basically a quasi-wholesale rate. Would that be a fair assessment of that?
Sure, Mr. Larson. Yes.
Thank you. And one more question, Representative Wagenius.
Well, I'm not sure that our testifier has finished, and if he's finished,
We're going to let him finish the testimony. He's got about one slide left, so he's almost finished.
Why don't I ask the question when he's finished?
That sounds great. Thank you. Mr. Larson.
I had hit the last point. This is it, yeah.
There we go. Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Our pollution control agency tells us that every year Minnesotans spend $30 billion on health care costs from air pollution. And electric utilities are a huge portion of that, probably. We're getting the exact number, but it's a huge portion of it. But $30 billion, no matter how big, it's big. So what are the health care costs attributable to your system?
Mr. Larson.
I have no idea. I know to answer your question, and we were talking in the committee last week, there was the whole value of solar effort. I know the value of solar calculation took into account environmental impacts.
Representative Wagenius?
Well, thank you. I think it's somewhat the same point that Representative Portman is making. If you're going to talk about cost shifting, then you can't pick and choose among costs. And if you don't include the health care costs that we are being incurred because of your generation of electricity and your use of it, then this cost shifting argument just air goes out of it, because we can't come up with a real number here. And so I think it's incumbent on all of us to understand what the health care costs are of electric generation. And that's particularly important when we talk about solar, because you're now reducing health care costs. That would be the same thing as wind. You're actually reducing health care costs. So that's a piece of the puzzle that just we need to get our hands on, and I don't feel like I have the information to get my hands on it. Can I ask it?
Thank you. Yep.
An entirely different question?
Can I answer that?
Yes, Mr. Larson.
I guess the way I would look at that, Representative Wagenius, is what we're looking at for the shifted costs is the recovery of our distribution facilities, particularly. I think separate is the issue that you're raising is the wholesale power cost and those impacts. I think to me it's a generation issue, and more specifically, if we're looking at to reduce these impacts, I would suggest we should be looking at the most cost-effective way of installing renewable energy. For example, we might look and say, can we achieve the same results of having more renewable energy and the reduced emissions by, for example, installing larger renewable systems rather than having the distributed systems?
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Well, you can't just say, well, somebody else produces it, so it doesn't count against me. I mean, that's not real. We're trying to deal with real costs, real money, what folks are paying. So I think we've still got to get our hands around that cost. But on a total different thing, we have heard from Xcel that it says it uses wind as a hedge against fuel costs. Do you do that?
Mr. Larson.
We're a distribution cooperative, so we purchase all of our wholesale energy from Great River Energy. So all of that happens on what we call the G&T side. So even to my prior answer, and I appreciate your point, I certainly didn't mean to imply that I'm pushing it aside, the issue. As a cooperative, we have two entities that work together. So I'm on the distribution side, and then we have Great River Energy handling the wholesale generation and issues. So I'm really not able to answer how they handle hedging or their purchases.
All right. And just one final comment, if you may, Representative Wagenius.
Well,
we need to move on.
It's all part and parcel of the same conversation.
Sure.
So it would be good for us to know from Great River Energy if it uses wind as a hedge against fuel costs. And then similarly, does it use solar as a hedge?
Thank you. Mr. Larson, thank you for your testimony. And again, thank you for coming back to wrapping up net metering. We're going to move along now back to our issue of the night and of current law. So again, I want to welcome Mr. Johnson to the table. So go ahead with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joel Johnson. I'm with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. We represent the 44 distribution co-ops in the state and the six G&Ts that supply them with power. What I'm going to talk about tonight is go over what happened in 2013 as it relates to electric co-ops, and then talk about what co-ops have done in terms of installing solar on their systems and kind of the different approach that we have taken compared to what was mandated for the IOUs. We were, as those of you who were here in 2013, we were opposed to the mandate, the solar mandate, and eventually we were excluded from any requirements in the legislation that passed along with the municipal utilities. Now, the key areas where our opposition were concerns over the overall cost of what was being proposed, the lack of demand among our generation and transmission cooperatives. Most were experiencing actually declining growth on their systems at the time, and there was concern that about the additional costs that would be added when you add new generation on top of excess generation that we already had. Again, what we consider the unfairness of the current net metering statute, and that has to do with the cost shifting. We are not-for-profit organizations, which means we have to recover all the costs that it takes us to serve our members. And if we are not allowed to recover those costs from some of our members, those get shifted on. Now, yes, there are all sorts of cross-subsidies when you're making rates, but these are pretty significant. At the typical rural co-op, you're talking about a cost shift of over $1,000 annually for people who completely net out their use and end up not paying. Now, that can vary depending on the size of the monthly fixed charge that the co-op charges and other issues, but that's about typical for your average rural system, with 10,000 customers and 4 to 5 meters per model of line. Those costs really do mean a lot, and they get shifted onto their neighbors quite significantly. And then, we opposed it mainly because, again, we consider the mandate kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to energy policy. And at the time, we were very concerned about what the cost of the 25 by 25 mandate was having on co-ops. And again, as we've discussed previously, we have completely different load curves, and we serve different types of customers than other IOUs. And what we had found that we were not able to integrate, particularly wind generation, as easily as other utilities were because of our lack of overnight load. And that was costing us pretty significant amount of money year after year in terms of what we were paying for that wind and then what we were getting back when we in turn sold it into the MISO market. We also said that we would be adding solar in response to our members' requests. And I think, right now, six community solar projects have come online at Minnesota Cooperative since 2013. Wright Hennepin Electric Cooperative in the western suburbs has two projects online, 53 kW and a 41 kW project. They have a third one that's a larger one expected to come on this spring. Lake Region, 39 kW project. Tri-County has two 32 kW projects. Conexus Energy has a 245 kW project that went online this summer. In addition, there are a number of additional projects that are expected to come online this summer. We're not quite sure yet what the final tally will be, but we're expecting probably another three or four to come online this summer. In addition to those community solar projects, Great River Energy, which is the largest G&T serving in the state, has added a 250 kW array at their headquarters in Maple Grove. They're using a mix of technologies and a mix of different panels, and that's in addition to an existing 72 kW array at their facility. They also are installing up to 19 additional arrays in member communities among their 20 fixed members, and those will be installed by the summer of 2015. GRE has also participated in several Department of Energy SunShot initiatives, and those are pilot projects that are looking at different ways of identifying and addressing barriers to solar PV on co-op lines, and also looking at different business models that will work for co-ops. Darylin Cooperative Power, which serves the southeast corner of the state, they've installed two utility-scale projects completed this year. Both are 517 kW, and one of them is located in Orinoco, right off of Highway 52, if you're driving down to Rochester. In addition, they have 70 community solar projects have come online at their 25 cooperatives in four states. Two of those are in Minnesota. Four more are in development, including a 100 kW project in Minnesota. Basin Power Cooperative has right now has 2.5 megawatts of DG solar projects installed, 93 total projects in all. In addition, they have created a pass-through rate for community solar projects on among their members in Minnesota. And that's a buy-all, sell-all arrangement. It allows co-op partners to take advantage of the tax credits that are available from the federal government. As I mentioned before, we're not for profit, so we can't use the tax credits. It provides a fixed rate for solar production, and two projects are planned right now in Minnesota, totaling 144 kilowatts. Minn Kota Energy Cooperative, which serves the northwest part of the state, they have two 5 kW demonstration projects right now at their member services, and one community solar project around Bemidji is nearing final approval. Now, I just want to add, Minn Kota Electric is a winter peaking system, so it's a challenge there to integrate the solar into their, more of a challenge for them to integrate solar on a cost-effective basis for them. And that's another key point when you're considering solar is when it fits winter peaking systems much less than it does summer peaking systems. Just talking about Wright Hennepin, they have the first operating community solar project in Minnesota. They originally, on this first project, used the net metering model where people purchased the panels themselves and then they were treated as normal net metered accounts. Wright Hennepin is actually is somewhat unique in Minnesota in that they purchase their energy from two G&Ts and they deal with two different daily demand peaks. And what Wright-Hennepin did with this first operating project was they tied it to storage, battery storage, and so that they would be able to offset their peaks. And that has the potential for pretty significant savings. One of the ways that distribution co-ops get charged by their generation and transmission co-ops is through demand charges. And if you can lower your peak demand charge, you can avoid a lot of cost demand charges from your G&T. So that had the potential for significant savings for them. Unfortunately, they quickly determined that the business model didn't work. They were seeing a lot of the same cross subsidies on the community solar project. Subsequent projects have used the business model closer to other cooperatives, and they're looking to replicate that with individual installations. Kind of the model that most of the co-ops have used now, the cooperative members sell the output from the solar panels. You're not buying the panel yourself. You're actually buying, agreeing to purchase the output. And this avoids the net metering requirements and the cross subsidies. Generally, in most of these cases, there's a third party partner that captures the tax credits. In most of the existing ones so far, it's been cooperative finance, corporation, which is kind of the main cooperative bank in the U.S., and then also Federated Insurance, not the one in Owatonna, but actually a cooperative insurance company out of Kansas. And what the members then are guaranteed a set or escalating rate dependent on how much money is paid up front. And that can go anywhere between, actually, you get all of the output for free if you put up enough front money, or typically what we're finding the kilowatt hour rates are coming in probably 2 or 3 cents above the retail rate right now. But those are expected to be lower probably within 2 to 3 years is what most of the co-ops are expecting. So what essentially you're buying then is a hedge against future rate increases through the purchase of the output from these community solar projects. And that's all I have. I can answer any questions that there are from committee members, but again, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. anybody have any questions from the committee? Mr. Johnson? Hearing none, thank you so much. Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. So I've had an opportunity to tour both Great River Energy in Maple Grove and also their new expansion, and then I've gone to Wright-Hennepin and toured all of their community solar gardens. And the day that I was there, especially at Wright-Hennepin, it was middle of the day, probably 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but it was cloudy. And so I said, okay, I want to see what you're generating, because at that time they told me, this is before some of their additional expansions, but they had, it was about a 30 kW. So we opened up the meter, and it was registering that it was producing about 10 kW. But I was able to see all of the battery, the series of batteries that they have to do the off-peak, you know, where they store it and then they release it when it's high peak, when it's peak, I mean. And can you just tell me, is there anybody else in the state of Minnesota that's doing what Wright-Hennepin is doing with the battery storage and then releasing it during peak time?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now among cooperatives, that's a unique, and it's really most of the cooperatives are watching closely to see how that process works and how the storage works. I do know that there are some other utility storage demonstrations around the state. I believe Xcel has one, and they could tell you more about that.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. So you don't have any information as far as any kind of cost savings or, you know, how that worked with, I mean, it was a pretty decent investment for the battery storage. They're a very expensive endeavor, so you don't have any information as far as what kind of return on investment or anything they might have encountered?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is available. I believe on Wright-Hennepin's website they have the performance data from both the storage and from the output of their community solar projects are available. I can get those numbers for you and share them if you're interested.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I would be. I think it'd be something important for, you know, if this is something that we're headed in that direction, it would be good to know, you know, return on investment if there ever is any, or if the cost of the battery is just so high that it's, you know, it's a nice idea, but it's still costs a lot more. It just would be nice to know the information. It was an interesting, you know, setup out there, but I'd like to know the facts.
Thank you. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick technical question. What kind of batteries are they? Are you using on the, to store this power that's generated from the solar, these solar fields?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know off the top of my head what batteries were. It was a company that I know that had experienced some financial troubles. So I can get back to you what the specific batteries were that they're using.
Thank you. Anything else? Follow up?
To that point, I think it's important that we make fully informed decisions. Oftentimes, battery storage involves, well, we have lead acid, we have alkaline, we have lithium, we have different types of energy storage within these batteries. And if we're going to be looking at the whole picture, I think that there should be an environmental impact statement that's done when we look at these massive battery banks that we're potentially going to be creating here. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thanks. Follow up to the two battery questions. It would be, I think, helpful if the chair would hold a hearing on what engineers are expecting in batteries over the next 5-10 years, because there are going to be lots of battery questions.
We'll put that on the notes. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Oh, Representative Mensah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was getting used to Matitza.
I do learn.
I just want to point out that we've got a couple things in regard to batteries. Manganese is being explored right now, and former Representative Radinovich's district, and that would be a source for this type of power storage that they're exploring. As well, we'd be happy to continue, hopefully, or be able to provide copper for some of these very soon.
Thank you. And again, thank you, Mr. Johnson, for your presentation.
Thank you.
We have two more testifiers tonight. I was going to bring in Betsy Engelking with the Geronimo Energy. If you could please come forward and introduce yourself for the record, please. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engelking, and I'm a vice president with Geronimo Energy. Geronimo is a wind and solar developer based in Edina, Minnesota, and we are the developer of the Aurora Distributed Solar Project, which is a 100-megawatt project that is distributed over 20-plus sites around the state of Minnesota, and Xcel Energy will be buying the output of that project when it's in service in 2016. I'm just going to take a few minutes to give you a quick overview of the solar structure in Minnesota and the industry and a little bit of you know, how solar works within the electric system as a whole. Solar is a very unique generating resource in that it's almost infinitely modular. You can have systems that are very, very small. I have one that runs a little windmill on my windowsill in the office. When the sun shines, the windmill turns. It's great if that would happen all the time. Or it can be a large-scale project that takes up acres and acres in a desert in, for example, California or Nevada. In Minnesota, I think we see sort of three primary models around the solar industry. There's the rooftop model, where anything from a residential customer to a small or large business puts solar on the roof of their building. There is sort of what we would call the distributed model, which is a larger scale solar project. It's always questionable what that is. It might be, you know, we have a 400 kW project at St. John's that we would consider distributed. It could be up to a 10-megawatt solar project like our Aurora projects. But those are unique in that they actually connect directly to the utility's distribution system, usually at a substation, and are absorbed by the local load in that area. And then there's the utility scale model, and these are the very large projects that typically will interconnect to the transmission system, very similar to a gas plant or a coal plant or a nuclear plant. And I think it won't surprise you, even though solar is infinitely modular, it does have economies of scale associated with it. So when you're looking at the cost of solar, typically, you will see that the smaller rooftop systems are going to be more expensive, either per watt, which is kind of the industry measurement, or per kilowatt hour, than the distributed solar systems, which are going to be more expensive than the utility scale solar systems. And I think a sort of a good measure right now is that a typical rooftop system without a lot of the subsidies that have been attached in the past, you know, they are typically going to be in about the 1.6 to 2 cent, 2 cents, excuse me, 16 to 20 cents a kilowatt hour. And a distributed system is probably going to be closer to the maybe 13 to 15 cents per kilowatt hour, and a utility scale system we've seen it can be as low as 7 to 10 cents a kilowatt hour. And so it's important to kind of note those different economies as you look at the development of solar. But they also serve different purposes. A rooftop system serves a customer who wants to generate their own electricity, and a utility scale actually serves the need of a utility that has to add capacity and energy. The middle piece to this is the solar gardens discussion, and I'm sure that Mr. Evans is going to talk about solar gardens, so I'm not going to talk about them a lot, but they tend to sort of bridge the rooftop to distributed area. There are some solar gardens that have been planned for rooftops. Most of the solar gardens have been planned as ground-mounted solar facilities that will interconnect to distribution utilities. There are a number of things that limit the size of a solar unit that you can put in any given site. One is, of course, the size of your roof. Another is your orientation or your shading on your roof, whether or not it can accommodate solar. If we're talking about ground-mounted facilities, one of them is available land. Available land, especially ag land, the difference between a solar project and a wind project is that a solar project takes 100% of the land out of production. And so in Minnesota, we've typically found, as we've tried to develop projects, that it's much easier to build smaller projects, particularly on the fringe of communities that have some load attached. We always tend to look for less valuable land, pasture land, marginal industrial land on the outskirts of cities, because we are sensitive to the fact that you take that agricultural land out of production. And our measure is typically about 7 acres of land to 1 megawatt of solar. Another thing that might limit it if you're distribution connected is the amount of load that you're trying to support. If you're connecting to a community and they use 5 megawatts of energy, then it could be very hard to put a project larger than 5 megawatts on there, because otherwise the energy will flow onto the system and onto the transmission system, and then it's not a distributed project anymore. Solar is a variable resource, I think, as you saw, as Mr. Larson sort of showed you in that graph. I call it a partially dispatchable resource because you can turn it off when it's running, but if the sun isn't shining, you can't turn it on. So in Minnesota, we are typically seeing somewhere between about a 19 and a 25% capacity factor for solar. Now, capacity factor is the number of hours you're generating relative to the total number of hours per year. So this says basically solar is generating between 19 and 25% of the hours of the year. Depending on whether you have a fixed installation that's simply tilted toward the south and oriented to pick up as much sun, or a tracking installation which actually tracks the sun from east to west during the day. The final thing that I think is important for the committee to think about when you think about solar is, how is solar different from wind? Because we hear a lot about both of them. They're both renewable. They're both variable resources. And I think Representative Wagenius was kind of getting at some of what I'm going to talk about here, is that wind energy is generated both on-peak and off-peak. It tends to blow. There's a significant amount of wind energy that comes during low-use periods. And that's not always night, because I hear Chair Garofalo frequently say it mostly blows at night. But I think it mostly blows in particular in the spring and fall months when energy use is low because we're neither heating nor cooling. It does tend to blow in more off-peak periods, so sometimes at night, on weekends, things like that. But wind energy is it's a solid, low-cost, I think what we would call a fuel alternative to coal and gas. It's not designed to provide any capacity benefit. It's simply designed to provide low-cost energy when it's generating. So, for example, some of the recent contracts that Xcel Energy has signed for wind power, it's actually delivering energy at a cost of about, between 2 and 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's pretty comparable to the dispatch cost of their coal plants. That's just the variable cost of running some of their coal plants. And so when it's actually displacing, off-peak energy frequently, it is cost-effective. Solar is almost always generated on-peak. It only generates when the sun shines, which is by definition the on-peak period in MISO. Although that does, it does vary as we get shorter days and longer days. But the nicest thing is that the highest generation correlates very strongly with the peak use of energy in Minnesota, which is the summer months in July and August. And in fact, we did a study when we designed our Aurora project, and we found out that the coincidence of solar with Xcel's peak is actually about, MISO's peak is actually about 70% of the time or more. And so you typically know that you're going to get that solar during your on-peak periods. When people are using a lot of electricity, it's hot and sunny, everybody's air conditioners are running. And the other thing about solar is that that is the time when energy costs are the highest, because that's the time when utilities are turning on their less efficient, higher cost, particularly their gas units, their combustion turbine units, which can dispatch at a very high cost depending on the cost of gas, somewhere between, anywhere from, 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour to, 10 or 11 cents a kilowatt hour. And so while solar may have a higher cost, it's typically also displacing much higher cost energy, and it's also contributing to the reliability of the system. Every utility is required to have a certain amount of capacity on their system to make sure that they can generate energy when customers need it. And solar contributes to that, and so it also displaces some of the capital costs of building a new gas plant, typically, or something like that. And so that's the overview that I put down, because I want to make sure everybody has time. But I'm really happy to answer any questions if you've got questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Engelking. Anybody have any questions from the committee? Oh, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. It's good to see you again. Thank you for coming to the committee. You had mentioned the Aurora project, which is your 100-megawatt project, and I know you've got three of those projects of the 22, I believe we had talked about, that are right in Wright County. And you had mentioned also that you're trying to look for spots that have more marginal-type use lands, pasture land, or not high production agricultural land, or highly valued industrial land. But I'm wondering if I have a two-part question. My first part question is: do you know how many acres that 100 megawatts will be using in total? And then the second is: I'll let you answer that, and then I have a follow-up question after that.
Ms. Engelking.
I don't have the exact number of acres right in front of me, but, given our ratio of about 7 acres per megawatt, it's probably in the 700 to 1,000-acre range.
And Representative O'Neill.
Right. So let's see. So the solar project that's in Buffalo Township, that's very near where I live, that was 75 acres, and it was 8.5 megawatts. So, okay, so that's about in the range. Okay, so then I have another question, because in Monticello, which is not far from where the other three places are that you've looked at, now this is a different solar developer, but just we're talking about solar in general. There have been two different developers that have come in from out of state and looked at a parcel of land that's 600 acres, and it happens to be immediately adjacent to Monticello, but it is prime real estate land, not marginal land. It's where the city plans to do their future growth. In other words, that's where they're going to do additional residential, industrial, and commercial property, because it overlooks I-94. It's prime real estate. It used to be a golf course, and the bank now owns it. So I'm wondering if you could just comment as to the, you know, since you said that the project that you do, you try to kind of steer clear of that sort of thing. Do you have any comment in general as we continue to expand solar in Minnesota? I know Xcel was here, and they said that their total resource plan is looking at 11,000 acres. So that's a lot of land across Minnesota, 11,000 acres. And if we kind of use the calculation that you had given me of the 75 acres was 8.5 megawatts, it could even be, you know, higher than that, 14 maybe, 1,000. But we'll just go with Xcel's 11,000 acres that we'll be using for solar. Do you have any guidance you could give us as the Energy Committee moving forward as to, the difficulty of this this pull back and forth between land use and being respectful of a city's development?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, as a developer, one of Geronimo's principles is to try to work with its communities. And I think that that's something that any developer needs to be sensitive to, is what the community has in its plans and, what it is, what kinds of requirements that it has. One of the things that, of course, governs solar development is permitting. And in Minnesota, a state site permit governs for installations 50 megawatts and above, or connected installations that total more than 50 megawatts. And so one of the areas where I think communities have a lot of say in what can go where is in their ordinances and their permitting. And in fact, the Department of Commerce has been running a kind of a task force or a stakeholder group with counties and developers talking about, you know, whether there are model ordinances that the counties can develop that talk about use. I mean, most of that solar is done on a local permitting issue. That being said, I mean, Geronimo in particular has really looked at a lot of those permitting issues. That's one of the reasons why we're not developing in Monticello, because we did feel that it worked with the planned uses of the city. And in fact, we also deferred another site in the Aurora project because there were specific plans for the particular parcel of land. There's a delicate balance, because the other thing about solar development, developers don't have eminent domain authority. And so one of the things we have to find to develop is we have to find willing sellers or willing leasers of our property. And so we have to always strike a balance between what land is obtainable, is it convenient to where you want to interconnect it, is it compatible with the uses that the county has laid out for solar, and all of those issues. And, really I would encourage, the area to work with the developers and to also work to come up with some kind of an ordinance that would help guide developers on where solar could be developed in your area.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I really do appreciate that you came out to my district, and we went to a couple meetings together and did just that. What you were describing is you were listening to the township, you were listening to the concerns of the neighbors around, and I know you're still working on some issues. I just got an email yesterday from one of the landowners near one of the pieces that you're going to be developing, and they're concerned about what they can see and all of that. And I really respect your business model and your care that you're taking, and I appreciate the fact that Geronimo didn't come into Monticello and look at that piece of land that I was just talking about. But my concern is the developers that are coming from out of state that don't have your concern, they don't have your integrity, because they have found that loophole. Because this is what the developers, two developers now from out of state, are coming in and telling the city of Monticello, well, our project is bigger than 50 megawatts, and so we don't care what you say, we're going to move forward because the PUC can just tell us yes. And so I have grave concern that that could be a big issue, not only in Monticello, but maybe across Minnesota as well. So just something to think about. I don't know that was thought of when we looked at this. Solar is just developing just exponentially, right? I mean, it's just this big, huge growth very, very quickly. So it's some things that we need to consider as a committee moving forward and how it affects our communities. And I really do appreciate the fact that you know about the piece of land that I'm talking about, and that you said, no, that's not a good place for us to expand to, because the city does have this development plan. They have an annexation plan. They have everything ready to go. And that is the future growth of Monticello. That is their industrial park. That is their commercial piece of property and their residential expansion. And they do hope to continue to grow. Wright County is one of the largest growing places in the state, when we have the boom. And so We expect that to continue to grow as the economy picks up. So I really appreciate Geronimo's care and concern, and I would just hope that our state developers would share your concern. And frankly, I'm not seeing it. So maybe we need as a committee to push them in that direction just a bit.
Thank you, Representative. Over to Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First thing, Ms. Engelking, thanks for your testimony. Can you just make sure everyone understood? Can you just cover the different zoning for over 50 megawatt versus under 50 megawatts so people understand that?
Over 50 megawatts, all generating facilities in the state are subject to a state site permit. And so the state site permit is it's heard before the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. It is required to follow a number of rules. And but another really important measure of that process is input. And in fact, I'm pinch hitting for our director of solar tonight because he is out at a series of week-long public hearings all around the state on our state site permit for our Aurora project. I think he's in Pipestone tonight. But that process is it's a state process, and it does preempt local zoning and local permitting ordinances, but it also takes into account input from the local governments, the cities, the townships, the counties, as well as the public as it goes forward. And also to get a state a site permit, there are also certain thresholds that the commission looks at. For example, any facility over 50 megawatts also requires a certificate of need in the state, and the certificate of need looks specifically at the facility, whether it's needed, whether somebody's buying the power, you know, some issues like that. So it's a fairly arduous process to go through. Under 50 megawatts, it's, with the exception of wind, which has a slightly different rule about when counties can and cannot permit wind locally, that's all local permitting, and so it would be permitted by whatever jurisdiction that it's in. So, for example, we have a project in Rosemont that's actually been permitted by the city of Rosemont because it's in the city limits, and it's permitted as a conditional use permit. There are other places where you would have to go to the county or to a township to obtain those permits.
Representative Gruff, did you have a follow-up?
She answered my second question already. Perfect. So thank you.
And Representative Metzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Metzo's also Finn, so don't worry. The question I would have is, our delegation had worked on some of the Made in Minnesota solar incentives, and do you see them as being effective and attracting jobs and business to the state?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the Made in Minnesota program has not grown as much as we would have liked to have seen it grow in terms of it favors a limited number of providers and doesn't necessarily favor all of the solar components that are made in Minnesota. I do think that, you know, Made in Minnesota is limited to a very sort of specialized set of customers. They tend to be rooftop customers because the products that right now are made in Minnesota are not licensed for ground use or they're not designed for ground use. I think that it is nice to see it attracting new business in the state, which I think is a true test of that kind of an incentive. I think that there's one new developer that's coming in. I would like to see it extended to other components that are made in Minnesota. So, for example, Anderson Windows develops a lot of the racks for rooftop systems, and, you know, systems using those racks are not afforded an incentive. There are other components that are made in Minnesota that aren't afforded those incentives. And so I think that, you know, the real test is, are we attracting businesses? And I think we are.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Separate question. The Department of Commerce ruled on a federal level on some of the Chinese solar dumping. Do you see that affecting the American marketplace and making American-made solar more cost-competitive?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we are seeing the market even out a little bit at this point. I think, you know, there are a lot of technology gains happening in solar, which is reducing prices. And so so we recently did a major bid for the solar components for our Aurora project, and I think what we found was that U.S. projects and foreign-made projects are almost back in parity again, and they're almost at the prices where the Chinese were at before the tariffs were instituted. And so I think we're actually seeing those tariffs have, you know, gone into effect. Everybody's adjusted, technology's improved, and we're kind of evening out on them.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you. And thank you for your testimony tonight, Ms. Ingle King. Our final testifier, Mr. Evans, if you could come down, please. And introduce yourself to the record, please. Thank you. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I'm going to be talking off of this sort of legal-sized spreadsheet this evening as I go through this. Before I start, let me just make a couple of notes. First of all, you know, a lot of people talk about the price of energy in different ways. I put this chart together using the cost per megawatt hour. Other people talk about the cost of kilowatt hour. And if you listen carefully, you'll find I get them mixed up sometimes. But just the way to think about it is 10 cents a kilowatt hour is the same as $100 a megawatt hour. So you just multiply the kilowatt hour price by 1,000 and you've got the megawatt hour price. So if you've been listening to other testifiers as they talk about kilowatt hour prices, you can translate that using the megawatt. The other thing I want to do is just make a correction on my spreadsheet over on the right side at the top where it says $119 to $140 per megawatt hour. I rechecked those numbers, and actually the correct numbers I think should be $114 to $150 a megawatt hour. And I'll get to, as I go through the presentation, I'll get to those numbers and what the significance of them is. So starting over on the right side, I have included a column for wind. Excuse me. And to sort of establish a reference point for non-emitting renewable energy, I certainly don't mean to suggest that wind and solar are comparable resources or they ought to be compared in terms of all of the things that Ms. Ingle King talked about. Those of you that were at the hearing when Kurt Hager from our resource planning group presented our resource plan, he talked about some of the different attributes of solar and wind. So by putting wind on the chart here, I'm not trying to indicate that it somehow is a trade-off between solar and wind. But it's a good, we've been doing wind for a lot longer in the state of Minnesota. The price, as you'll see, has come down significantly. You know, maybe it's on there as at least the goal of where we'd like to see solar go as we work our way through these programs. But just as I think Ms. Ingle King referred, we're buying wind. We see out in the marketplace that we can buy wind. She said down to 2 cents, or 2 cents would be $20 a megawatt hour. I've got 25 to 30, so we're in that range. How much of that will, you know, are we going to have to acquire? How much of that will we acquire? We have a 30% mandate by 2020. That's the current law, so we have to acquire at least that much. Doesn't all have to be wind, but wind happens to be, you know, the best resource to meet that mandate. But as Mr. Hager pointed out a couple of weeks ago when he presented our resource plan, we're starting to see wind actually be competitive in the marketplace, either as a hedge against gas or in its own right. And so we will probably exceed our 30% mandate on our system just because the price of wind and the way it integrates on our system works for us. Moving then to the right, we talk about utility-scale solar. Typically, utility-scale solar, we expect we will purchase the same way we purchase most of our wind, which is we don't actually own the wind generation. We purchase the energy from a development. We would expect that to be the case most of the time with utility-scale solar, where we would put out a bid asking people to propose a certain amount of solar, and they would propose a price and a location and the other details of their project. As we look at the market now, we think those projects are likely to come in at somewhere between $75 and $100 a megawatt hour. So while it's more than wind power, it also has other attributes, and it's actually quite a bit lower price than what we expected to see out in the market at this time. So we're encouraged by that price. Our current mandate is to to purchase 100 or 1.5% of our energy by 2020 on our system, that would be a little over 300 megawatts of solar. Again, as Mr. Hager indicated a couple of weeks ago, we are projecting out into the future that we may exceed that 1.5% in part on anticipation that the price of solar will come down. But that sort of remains to be seen. It is currently in our resource plan. So then, you know, really the challenge that we see with utility scale solar is the price. The price is above some other alternatives, though they're not, as I said, completely comparable. But we're hoping to see that price come down. And so that's one of the challenges that we see going forward with utility scale solar. Moving to the next column is the rooftop solar. And here the pricing gets a little bit complicated and possibly even controversial, though I've tried to accurately reflect it. First of all, you need to understand, as I think others have testified, that that this energy comes on our system as a net metered system. Mr. Eloff did a good job explaining the value of solar, which was an alternative tariff. I think he also explained that no utility so far has chosen it. It's a utility election to go with the value of solar tariff versus net metering. I think all the utilities, including us, have chosen to stick with the net metering model for the rooftop solar. Now, because it goes on individuals' homes and businesses, and the energy is used by those customers in their home and business, it's a little hard to talk about what the price or the price impact on our customers is. What I've tried to do here is reflect two elements of the cost of net metered solar. One being the incentive or subsidy programs that are provided to that generation, and the other being the cost shift that we've heard so much about over the last couple of hearings in the committee. The range in sizes is a range that's caused by the fact that not all of our customers pay the same rate. We have different rates for commercial industrial customers, different rates for residential customers, different rates for small business customers. And so the range really falls into the is determined by the amount of, or by the size of the customer and the type of customer that we're serving. As I think Mr. Eloff mentioned, our solar rewards program is paid for by Xcel Energy, by Xcel Energy customers. It's about 8 cents or $80 a megawatt hour, 8 cents a kilowatt hour. And adding that to the cost shift is where I got the numbers that are on there. As I said, other people may have different ways of calculating that, though I think it's probably a pretty fair estimation. And it makes sense, of course. It's going to be more expensive to put solar on people's rooftops. It's going to be less efficient because of trees and buildings and the house doesn't point in exactly the right direction and all that sort of thing. So it would make sense that utility-scale solar, which you can put up in wide open spaces, put on a tracking system and other kinds of things that Ms. Engelking talked about, you know, it makes sense that the rooftop solar would be more expensive to our customers. The Made in Minnesota program is an incentive program that's actually administered by the Department of Energy Resources. They put together that incentive program. Mr. Eloff mentioned it ranges in amount from, I think, $130 to $390 a megawatt hour as an incentive for the Made in Minnesota program. So how much of those kinds of resources are we going to acquire on our system at Xcel Energy? It's limited by the fact that those incentive programs are paid for out of dedicated funds. $5 million a year is by law devoted to the solar rewards program. So that $80 per megawatt hour incentive program is limited to $5 million a year, and that's how much we will get. The Made in Minnesota program is $15 million a year. As I think was indicated, not all of that money comes from Xcel Energy customers, but the fact is about 95% of it does, and that's just because, one, we're the biggest conservation program in the state, and two, the balance is made up from our Renewable Development Fund, which comes from our customers. So those are sort of the caps or the limits, you might say, on how much of the rooftop solar is going to be acquired, at least in the current time period. The challenges with rooftop solar, you've already heard about. One, the price is high. We want those prices to come down. The good news is that our customers are exposed to less of that high price because the incentive programs are limited. And the other challenge is the cost shift, which you've probably heard about until you don't want to hear about it anymore, so I won't talk about it anymore. But that cost shift, I think the point that Representative Hortman was making, at low levels of penetration, the cost shift is hard to calculate. It's a tiny little amount on our other customers' bills. But our concern and the challenge that we have is, as that resource grows and as more and more people put rooftop solar on their homes and businesses, if that's what happens, then that cost shift could actually become significant, as Mr. Johnson was talking about with the co-ops. So we think it's important early on to get the rules right, because it's going to be hard to sort of change the rules after a lot of people have gotten invested in this. So that's an ongoing concern, not an immediate concern, because the penetration of the rooftop solar is still pretty modest. And so then we come to community solar, and this is the brand new program. We've got more challenges here, as you can see on the chart, but then that's to be expected. It's a new program. We've never done it before. The law was passed in 2013 and is only now being implemented through the Public Utilities Commission. So the community solar is not net metered. The community solar is what we call a buy-all, what I call a buy-all, sell-all proposition. So what happens is, if a customer subscribes to a community solar garden, we continue to meter their energy use just like we did before they subscribed. And we measure each kilowatt hour that they use in their home or business, and we send them a bill at the same rate that we billed them for before. So nothing changes. They continue to buy all of their energy from Xcel Energy at the same rate. That helps eliminate the cost, or that actually eliminates the cost shift, because, of course, those customers are paying the entire blended rate, including the fixed costs. And they're paying it in real time as they receive those bills from Xcel Energy. And then the other side of that buy-all, sell-all is the sell-all. They own a share of a community solar garden. They have subscribed to a share. I shouldn't say own. They have subscribed to a share of a community solar garden. And we meter all the energy that comes off of their share, and we purchase that energy from them. So that's the buy-all, sell-all part of this proposition. They buy all of their energy from us that they use in their home or business. They sell all the energy to us that they produce in their subscription to the solar garden. And the price for that subscription, the price of that energy that they sell to us, is set by the Public Utilities Commission. It's between, in my corrected numbers, $114 to $150 a megawatt hour, depending, again, on what kind of customer it is, a business customer or a residential customer, a small business, large business, and that sort of thing. So, and the way we purchase that is essentially to give them a credit on their bill. So, as I said, we measure the amount of energy they're using at their home or business and calculate a monthly bill just like we did before, and then we find out how much energy their share of the solar garden produced, and we calculate it using the rates shown here, and we give them a credit on the bill. So that's the way that works. So essentially, our customers, because then that credit that we credit to their bill, we pass through to our customers through our fuel clause. So that's a dollar for dollar. It's not marked up. There's nothing else to it. It's just, if we pay them $114, we pass $114 through to our customers. And that program is, as noted here, an unlimited program. So there's no cap on that. There's no spending limit on that. We take as much of the solar garden proposals as come in and as qualify and make it through the process to become an actual solar garden. So this presents us with some new challenges, and maybe I should say before I start going through them that, you know, there is an ongoing docket with the Public Utilities Commission that's looking at the community solar program. Today we filed some comments with the Public Utilities Commission in that docket to look at some of these challenges, to bring some of these challenges to their attention. And of course, all the other parties who are interested in this will be able to file comments as well, and the Public Utilities Commission will have to sort through some of these and see if they want to do anything about it. So let me just go quickly through the challenges, and then I'll be happy to answer some questions if you have any. First of all, the unlimited nature of the program makes it impossible for us to limit the exposure of our customers to the prices that we're paying. So as you see, you know, for example, in the rooftop solar, we are paying some high price for that energy as well, but it's limited by the amount of subsidy that's available to pay the incentive. That doesn't exist in the community solar, so there's a little bit of nervousness about, well, how much of this stuff are we going to have to take at what is still a relatively high price for energy? When we opened the program a few weeks ago, we were expecting about 25 megawatts of proposals. I've heard other people who were expecting maybe 50 megawatts of proposals. We got 431 megawatts of proposals in the program. Now, as I talk through this further, you'll understand not necessarily all of those programs are going to get built, but it was disconcerting to think that our customers might be exposed to that much of this energy, which is, you know, frankly a little more expensive than similar solar energy that we could get. So that's one challenge. The second challenge that we had is, while the law requires that solar gardens be limited to 1 megawatt in size, something I learned as you work in this process, and those of you that have been here a while realize, it's kind of hard to put words in statutes and, you know exactly how they're going to be interpreted. So the question came up to the Public Utilities Commission, I'm told, I wasn't there, well, what if somebody builds a 1 megawatt project and then another 1 megawatt project right next to it? So it looks like a 2 megawatt project, but it's because they're right next to each other, but we can call them 2 1-megawatt projects. And the solar, and the PUC said, well, you know, the adjacent projects, you know, we're gonna allow that. I think what they maybe didn't expect, certainly what we didn't expect, is that almost, well, I should say 94% of the 431 megawatts that were proposed to us are projects that are adjacent to one another. One of them is 40 megawatts. Another one is 30 megawatts. A couple of them are 20 megawatts. And so the concern is that if you're able to aggregate all of those together, it starts to look a lot like utility scale solar. And as you can see on the chart, the price of utility scale solar is like $75 to $100, not $114 to $150. And so the challenge for the PUC that we've sort of presented to the PUC, they get all this stuff dumped on them, I guess, is what do you think about that? I mean, you set a price thinking these were kind of 1 megawatt small community scale projects, and what we ended up with is 40 megawatt projects largely out in the country that look an awful lot like the utility scale projects. And so we've asked the PUC to take a look at that and see if we can help address that challenge. The next challenge, number 4, that I've shown on the list, and this is really more anecdotal, but what we seem to be seeing is that larger commercial and industrial customers are the ideal subscriber, especially if you're building one of these very large solar gardens. And that's not hard to figure out. If you had to administer a program with 200 residential subscribers, you know, there'd be costs and people move away and people don't pay their bills and, you know, you've got all kinds of things you have to deal with. But if you can sign up 5 big corporations as subscribers, it's a lot easier. And so, again, we expected business and commercial industrial customers would be able to participate in solar gardens. But if the anecdotal information is true that this is being largely marketed to those folks, you run the risk of really buying pretty expensive energy from commercial and industrial customers, which is being paid for largely by residential customers. And so we've asked the PUC to take a look at that. And then finally, this is a complicated subject, and you will get past my depth very quickly on this, but we're running into some interconnection questions. Each of these solar gardens need to be connected to a substation. If a solar garden is 1 megawatt, you know, the substation, most of our substations can take that. There may be some issues. But if a solar garden is 40 megawatts and you're trying to connect that into a substation that doesn't have room for 40 megawatts, you either start implicating the transmission grid, in which case we get into FERC jurisdiction, and that opens a whole can of worms, or you start having to spend money to upgrade substations to accommodate the solar gardens. And that was not something, because we didn't anticipate the size of some of these gardens, we also didn't anticipate, well, what are you going to do if you start overwhelming substations? Who should pay for the upgrade to the substations that occur because of this? So, again, this community solar program is a new program. It was designed in 2013. We participated in that. I think we've run into some unexpected challenges with that, some unintended consequences. It's in the hands of the Public Utilities Commission, at least at this point, to try to help us sort through all of those. And I guess I'd say stay tuned. We'll see how it all works out.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. Representative Portman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, in the community solar situation where you have those 431 megawatts of applications, in what situations do you get to say no? Is it if the project doesn't, if their financing doesn't hold up, if the interconnection doesn't work? In what? So how do you figure that the sorting will happen with those projects? I'm sure some of them ultimately won't. You will get to, as a company, say, no, that doesn't work. And what are those kind of situations?
Mr. Chair, you know, the first thing that happened, of course, is there's a fairly extensive application process that they go through. And I think of the 431, about 100 megawatts were returned to the applicant saying, you know, there's something wrong with your application. Those are likely to be fixed and just sent back, but you never know. Some people might, you know, there might be some problems. Certainly, if they couldn't finance the construction of their system, it won't get built. That wouldn't be a choice we make. That'll just be the fact that if you can't build it, you can't build it, and then we won't buy it. So I think that'll be a problem. I'm not sure exactly. It's really not our program, and it's not really a regulated program, how they sign up subscribers. So I don't know what their situation would be with subscribers if for some reason they weren't able to perform. But that, you know, we haven't encountered that yet. There is a pretty significant cash deposit that is required with your application. I think it's $100,000. It's refundable. You will get it back. Even if you build the system, you'll get it back. It's just there to prove that you have the financial wherewithal to build the project. $100,000 won't build the project, but it certainly shows that you've got some financial backing. So, but obviously, if you can't afford to build it, you won't build it. The interconnection is a real problem. I mean, that could be a problem. A lot of these proposals came in, you know, in the same location. Guess what? Solar developers looked around and they all started looking at some of the same pieces of property, or very closely adjacent properties, and so the interconnection problem, you know, may be the one that really weeds some people out. Particularly, you know, it I guess from our point of view, I don't think we would ask our customers necessarily to upgrade the substation. And so then it's, well, which of the developers are going to pay? And if that throws your financials off, then that's a problem. So I think probably that's going to be the, you know, one of the tests, is just how much room do we have on our system for all of these systems that are being proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Portman.
Thank you. Just to follow up, when will we know which ones are going forward and when will they start to get built?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. It's an ongoing process. I mean, we're processing the applications. I know we haven't processed all of them. And then there's an engineering study that needs to be done by us to see, you know, what's going to be required in order to get the systems hooked up. And then, you know, the ongoing process with the Public Utilities Commission, where we're essentially asking them to help us sort through some of these challenges and figure out how to deal with them. So I'm afraid I can't really tell you. I expect, you know, it'll take, you know, a year or two before, you know, all of this gets sorted out. And, of course, in the meantime, others can still propose, so there may be more projects coming along.
Mr. Chair, I think this is my last question. Two questions. You don't mean a year or two until the first community solar project gets constructed in Minnesota?
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. No, I don't think I meant that. I think I meant just before we sort through all of these 431 and figure out how it's all going to work.
And then my last question. So on the linking issue, is that the subject of some ongoing dispute resolution process at the PUC, or has that been finally decided and Xcel is either determined not to appeal that determination, or is that still, you know, in the process of maybe going to an administrative law judge or some other proceeding at the PUC?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I don't know. I mean, it's very new. We don't really know. I know there was discussion early on when the program was put together about adjacent projects. I don't think anybody was contemplating 40 megawatts of adjacent 1-megawatt projects. And so that's going to be a challenge to go through. I don't know the answer. You know, and you can realize, I mean, this is sort of a legislative drafting problem when you think about it. Well, what are you going to say? They have to be a mile apart? you know, well, that may not be fair. Maybe they don't need to be a mile apart. Are you going to have to say they can't be on the same piece of property? Well, what if it's two different? You know, so it just gets hard to say, well, we wanted these to be small, relatively small, 1 megawatt community solar projects, and this is what we got. How are we going to sort that through? I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Yes, Evans, if you could just find out from HQ what, you know, where that is in the process at the PUC. I'd just be really interested to know that adjacent community solar project question where, you know, we're legislators. We don't necessarily understand all the ins and outs of how dockets proceed at the PUC, but if you can find out and convert it to plain English of where we are, if the appeal's been done or there's still some dispute going on and levels of appeal left to go through, I think that'd be helpful.
I will try to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I'm just curious about the land again. You had come in, or XL had come in before with your development plan, and I believe you said it was about 2,200 megawatts of solar in your plans moving forward, and that was going to be needing about 11,000 acres. But when Betsy Engel had come down from Geronimo Energy, who you're buying energy from, she gave us the figure of approximately 10 acres per megawatt, or you know, about 1,000 acres for the 100-megawatt project that she's got for the Aurora project. So those numbers kind of don't match. So I'm just wondering if maybe, if you don't know now, but maybe if you bring back something that's a little bit, you know, how did you arrive at 11,000 acres when, you know, if I do the math that she just gave me and she's the developer that's selling you energy, that's more like 22,000 acres, not 11,000 acres? I wonder if you could just help us understand the difference.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, I think we did the math sitting right here with this group of people. So I'll have to do, I mean, we sort of think in terms of 7 megawatt or 7 acres for a megawatt, which I think is consistent with what Ms. Engelking said. So, but, you know, every system is going to be different. We won't know till it's built, you know, depending on what's in the way and what you have to work around and, you know, what other rules or regulations or zoning laws or whatever. So, you know, I think if I come back, what I'll come back with and say it's about 7 acres a megawatt on average. And if it's 2,200 megawatts, you know, times seven, that's the number.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Yeah, because I was just, you know, I've got three in Wright County, and I got to see the very detailed plan in one of them that's right next to my home. And, you know, we're talking about different varyings of buffer zones and fences and all of that. So you think 7 is closer than 10? 7 is the number that you went with, not 10?
I think 7 is closer to the number. But, I mean, I'll talk to our folks and get back to you and see if there's a better range that they can maybe give you. But that's kind of what they've told me in the past is, you know, 7 to 8 acres per megawatt for solar. But again, it's going to depend on, you know, where the trees are, where the hills are, where the, you know, a whole bunch of other factors. So I'm sure that's why some will take 10 acres to get a megawatt. I imagine that's true, just depending on the sort of the lay of the land.
Thank you. We've got one further question from Representative Neuberger. And then we'll wrap things up at 8 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Evans, as I sit here and I listen, and we've had discussions ongoing about the community solar program, and I'm just, I guess the way that this is all kind of unfolding, what was originally intended to be small community solar gardens seems to be turning into something unintended, more like a corporate solar garden. It seems to be that's kind of Frankenstein's monster that seems to be trying to come out here and expose itself. I just, if we're going from 1 megawatt little, you know, power your half your neighborhood type of concepts to 40 megawatt corporate loopholes, I would encourage us to explore that further, and hopefully we can get our heads around this.
Thank you, Representative. And again, I want to thank you, Mr. Evans, for coming tonight, and thank all the testifiers for sticking around late this evening. I want to remind the committee that we have a meeting tomorrow, 12:45 in room 10. We'll see you all then, and this meeting is adjourned.
operating relative to the total number of hours per year. So this says basically solar is generating between 19% and 25% of the hours of the year. Depending on whether you have a fixed installation that's simply tilted toward the south and oriented to pick up as much sun, or a tracking installation which actually tracks the sun from east to west during the day. The final thing that I think is important for the committee to think about when you think about solar is, how is solar different from wind? Because we hear a lot about both of them. They're both renewable. They're both variable resources. And I think Representative Wagenius was kind of getting at some of what I'm going to talk about here, is that wind energy is generated both on-peak and off-peak. It tends to blow... There's a significant amount of wind energy that comes during low-use periods, and that's not always night, because I hear Chair Garofalo frequently say it mostly blows at night. But I think it mostly blows, in particular, in the spring and fall months when energy use is low because we're neither heating nor cooling. It does tend to blow in more off-peak periods, so sometimes at night, on weekends, things like that. But wind energy is a solid, low-cost, I think what we would call a fuel alternative to coal and gas. It's not designed to provide any capacity benefit. It's simply designed to provide low-cost energy when it's generating. So, for example, some of the recent contracts that Xcel Energy has signed for wind power, it's actually delivering energy at a cost of about, between 2 and 2.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's pretty comparable to the dispatch cost of their coal plants. That's just the variable cost of running some of their coal plants. And so when it's actually displacing, off-peak energy frequently, it is cost-effective. Solar is almost always generated on-peak. It only generates when the sun shines, which is by definition the on-peak period in MISO. Although that does, it does vary as we get shorter days and longer days. But the nicest thing is that the highest generation correlates very strongly with the peak use of energy in Minnesota, which is the summer months in July and August. And in fact, we did a study when we designed our Aurora project, and we found out that the coincidence of solar with Xcel's peak is actually about, MISO's peak is actually about 70% of the time or more. And so you typically know that you're going to get that solar during your on-peak periods. When people are using a lot of electricity, it's hot and sunny, everybody's air conditioners are running. And the other thing about solar is that that is the time when energy costs are the highest, because that's the time when utilities are turning on their less efficient, higher cost, particularly their gas units, their combustion turbine units, which can dispatch at a very high cost depending on the cost of gas, somewhere between, anywhere from, 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour to, 10 or 11 cents a kilowatt hour. And so while solar may have a higher cost, it's typically also displacing much higher cost energy, and it's also contributing to the reliability of the system. Every utility is required to have a certain amount of capacity on their system to make sure that they can generate energy when customers need it. And solar contributes to that, and so it also displaces some of the capital costs of building a new gas plant, typically, or something like that. And so that's basically the overview that I put down, because I want to make sure everybody has time. But I'm really happy to answer any questions if you've got questions.
Thank you so much, Ms. Engelking. Anybody have any questions from the committee? Oh, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. Good to see you again. Thank you for coming to the committee. You had mentioned the Aurora project, which is your 100-megawatt project, and I know you've got three of those projects of the 22, I believe, we had talked about that are right in Wright County. And you had mentioned also that you're trying to look for spots that have more marginal-type use lands, pasture land, or not high production agricultural land, or highly valued industrial land. But I'm wondering if I have a two-part question. My first part question is, do you know how many acres that 100 megawatts will be using in total? And then the second is, I'll let you answer that, and then I have a follow-up question after that.
Ms. Engelking.
You know, I don't have the exact number of acres right in front of me, but, you know, given our ratio of about 7 acres per megawatt, it's probably in the 700 to 1,000 acre range.
And Representative O'Neill.
Right. So let's see. So the solar project that's in Buffalo Township, that's very near where I live, that was 75 acres and it was 8.5 megawatts. So, okay, so that's about in the range. Okay, so then I have another question, because in Monticello, which is not far from where the other three places are that you've looked at, now this is a different solar developer, but just we're talking about solar in general. There have been two different developers that have come in from out of state and looked at a parcel of land that's 600 acres. And it happens to be immediately adjacent to Monticello, but it is prime real estate land, not marginal land. It's where the city plans to do their future growth. In other words, that's where they're going to do additional residential, industrial, and commercial property, because it overlooks I-94. It's prime real estate. It used to be a golf course, and the bank now owns it. So I'm wondering if you could just comment as to the, you know, since you said that the project that you do, you try to kind of steer clear of that sort of thing. Do you have any comment in general as we continue to expand solar in Minnesota? I know Xcel was here, and they said that their total resource plan is looking at 11,000 acres. So that's a lot of land across Minnesota, 11,000 acres. And if we kind of use the calculation that you had given me of the 75 acres was 8.5 megawatts, it could even be, you know, higher than that, 14 maybe, 1,000, but we'll just go with Xcel's 11,000 acres that we'll be using for solar. Do you have any guidance you could give us as the Energy Committee moving forward as to, the difficulty of this this pull back and forth between land use and being respectful of a city's development?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, as a developer, one of Geronimo's principles is to try to work with its communities. And I think that's something that any developer needs to be sensitive to, is what the community has in its plans and, what it is, what kinds of requirements that it has. One of the things that, of course, governs solar development is permitting. And in Minnesota, a state site permit governs for installations 50 megawatts and above, or connected installations that total more than 50 megawatts. And so one of the areas where I think communities have a lot of say in what can go where is in their ordinances and their permitting. And in fact, the Department of Commerce has been running a kind of a task force or a stakeholder group with counties and developers talking about, you know, whether there are model ordinances that the counties can develop that talk about use. I mean, most of that solar is done on a local permitting issue. That being said, I mean, Geronimo in particular has really looked at a lot of those permitting issues. That's one of the reasons why we're not developing in Monticello, because we didn't feel that it worked with the planned uses of the city. And in fact, we also deferred another site in the Aurora project because there were specific plans for the particular parcel of land. There's a delicate balance, because the other thing about solar development, developers don't have eminent domain authority. And so one of the things we have to find to develop is we have to find willing sellers or willing leasers of our property. And so we have to always strike a balance between what land is obtainable, is it convenient to where you want to interconnect it, is it compatible with the uses that the county has laid out for solar, and all of those issues. And, really I would encourage, the area to work with the developers and to also work to come up with some kind of an ordinance that would help guide developers on where solar could be developed in your area.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. You know, and I really do appreciate that you came out to my district, and we went to a couple meetings together and did just that. What you were describing is you were listening to the township, you were listening to the concerns of the neighbors around, and I know you're still working on some issues. I just got an email yesterday from one of the landowners near one of the pieces that you're going to be developing, and they're concerned about what they can see and all of that. And I really respect your business model and your care that you're taking. And I appreciate the fact that Geronimo didn't come into Monticello and look at that piece of land that I was just talking about. But my concern is the developers that are coming from out of state that don't have your concern, that don't have your integrity, because they have found that loophole. because this is what the developers, two developers now from out of state, are coming in and telling the city Monticello, well, our project is bigger than 50 megawatts, and so we don't care what you say, we're going to move forward because the PUC can just tell us yes. And so I have grave concern that that could be a big issue, not only in Monticello, but maybe across Minnesota as well. So just something to think about. I don't know that that was thought of when we looked at this. Solar is just developing just exponentially, right? I mean, it's just this big, huge growth very, very quickly. So it's some things that we need to consider as a committee moving forward and how it affects our communities. And I really do appreciate the fact that you know about the piece of land that I'm talking about and that you said, no, that's not a good place for us to expand to because the city does have this development plan. They have an annexation plan. They have everything ready to go. And that is the future growth of Monticello. That is their industrial park. That is their commercial piece of property and their residential expansion. And they do hope to continue to grow. Wright County is one of the largest growing places in the state, you know, when we have the boom. And so we expect that to continue to grow as the economy picks up. So I really appreciate Geronimo's care and concern. And I would just hope that our state developers would share your concern. And frankly, I'm not seeing it. So maybe we need as a committee to push them in that direction just a bit.
Thank you, Representative. Over to Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First thing, Ms. Engelking, thanks for your testimony. Can you just make sure everyone understood? Can you just cover the different zoning for over 50 megawatt versus under 50 megawatts so people understand that?
Over 50 megawatts, all generating facilities in the state are subject to a state site permit. And so the state site permit is it's heard before the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. It is required to follow a number of rules. But another really important measure of that process is input. And in fact, I'm pinch hitting for our director of solar tonight because he is out at a series of week-long public hearings all around the state on our state site permit for our Aurora project. I think he's in Pipestone tonight. But so that process is a state process, and it does preempt local zoning and local permitting ordinances, but it also takes into account input from the local governments, the cities, the townships, the counties, as well as the public as it goes forward. And also to get a state a site permit, there are also certain thresholds that the commission looks at. For example, any facility over 50 megawatts also requires a certificate of need in the state, and the certificate of need looks specifically at the facility, whether it's needed, whether somebody's buying the power, you know, some issues like that. So it's a fairly arduous process to go through. Under 50 megawatts, it's, you know, with the exception of wind, which has a slightly different rule about when counties can and cannot permit wind locally. That's all local permitting, and so it would be permitted by whatever jurisdiction that it's in. So, for example, we have a project in Rosemont that's actually been permitted by the city of Rosemont because it's in the city limits, and it's permitted as a conditional use permit. There are other places where you would have to go to the county or to a township to obtain those permits.
Representative Gruff, what did you have a follow-up?
She answered my second question already. Perfect. So thank you.
And Representative Metzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just Metzo's also Finn, so don't worry. The question I would have is our delegation had worked on some of the Made in Minnesota solar incentives, and do you see them as being effective and attracting jobs and business to the state?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the Made in Minnesota program has not grown as much as we would have liked to have seen it grow in terms of it favors a limited number of providers and doesn't necessarily favor all of the solar components that are made in Minnesota. I do think that, you know, Made in Minnesota is limited to a very sort of specialized set of customers. They tend to be rooftop customers because the products that right now are made in Minnesota are not licensed for ground use or they're not designed for ground use. I think that it is nice to see it attracting new business in the state, which I think is a true test of that kind of an incentive. I think that there's one new developer that's coming in. I would like to see it extended to other components that are made in Minnesota. So, for example, Anderson Windows develops a lot of the racks for rooftop systems, and, you know, systems using those racks are not afforded an incentive. You know, there are other components that are made in Minnesota that aren't afforded those incentives. And so I think that, you know, the real test is, are we attracting businesses? And I think we are.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Benson.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Separate question. The Department of Commerce ruled on a federal level on some of the Chinese solar dumping. Do you see that affecting the American marketplace and making American-made solar more cost-competitive?
Ms. Engelking.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that we are seeing the market even out a little bit at this point. I think, you know, there are a lot of technology gains happening in solar, which is reducing prices. And so so we recently did a major bid for the solar components for our Aurora project. And I think what we found was that U.S. projects and foreign-made projects are almost back in parity again, and they're almost at the prices where the Chinese were at before the tariffs were instituted. And so I think we're actually seeing those tariffs have, you know, gone into effect. Everybody's adjusted, technology's improved, and we're kind of evening out on them.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you. And thank you for your testimony tonight, Ms. Engelking. Our final testifier, Mr. Evans, if you could come down, please. And introduce yourself to the record, please. Thank you. And welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I'm going to be talking off of this sort of legal-sized spreadsheet this evening as I go through this. Before I start, let me just make a couple of notes. First of all, a lot of people talk about the price of energy in different ways. I put this chart together using the cost per megawatt hour. Other people talk about the cost of kilowatt hour, and if you listen carefully, you'll find I get them mixed up sometimes. But just the way to think about it is 10 cents a kilowatt hour is the same as $100 a megawatt hour. So you just multiply the kilowatt hour price by 1,000, and you've got the megawatt hour price. So if you've been listening to other testifiers as they talk about kilowatt hour prices, you can translate that using the megawatt. The other thing I want to do is just make a correction on my spreadsheet over on the right side at the top where it says $119 to $140 per megawatt hour. I rechecked those numbers, and actually the correct numbers I think should be $114 to $150 a megawatt hour. And I'll get to, as I go through the presentation, I'll get to those numbers and what the significance of them is. So starting over on the right side, I have included a column for wind, excuse me, to sort of establish a reference point for non-emitting renewable energy. I certainly don't mean to suggest that wind and solar are comparable resources or they ought to be compared in terms of all of the things that Ms. Engelking talked about. Those of you that were at the hearing when Kurt Hager from our resource planning group presented our resource plan, he talked about some of the different attributes of solar and wind. So by putting wind on the chart here, I'm not trying to indicate that it somehow is a trade-off between solar and wind, but it's a good, we've been doing wind for a lot longer in the state of Minnesota. The price, as you'll see, has come down significantly. You know, maybe it's on there as at least the goal of where we'd like to see solar go as we work our way through these programs. But just as I think Ms. Engelking referred, we're buying wind. We see out in the marketplace that we can buy wind. She said down to 2 cents, or 2 cents would be $20 a megawatt hour. I've got 25 to 30, so we're in that range. How much of that will, you know, are we going to have to acquire? How much of that will we acquire? We have a 30% mandate by 2020. That's the current law, so we have to acquire at least that much. Doesn't all have to be wind, but wind happens to be, you know, the best resource to meet that mandate. But as Mr. Hager pointed out a couple of weeks ago when he presented our resource plan, we're starting to see wind actually be competitive in the marketplace, either as a hedge against gas or in its own right. And so we will probably exceed our 30% mandate
on our system just because the price of wind and the way it integrates on our system works for us. Moving then to the right, we talk about utility scale solar. Typically, utility scale solar, we expect we will purchase the same way we purchase most of our wind, which is we don't actually own the wind generation. We purchase the energy from a development. We would expect that to be the case most of the time with utility scale solar, where we would put out a bid asking people to propose a certain amount of solar, and they would propose a price and a location and the other details of their project. As we look at the market now, we think those projects are likely to come in at somewhere between $75 and $100 a megawatt hour. So while it's more than wind power, it also has other attributes, and it's actually quite a bit lower price than what we expected to see out in the market at this time. So we're encouraged by that price. Our current mandate is to purchase 1.5% of our energy by 2020. On our system, that would be a little over 300 megawatts of solar. Again, as Mr. Hager indicated a couple of weeks ago, we are projecting out into the future that we may exceed that 1.5%, in part on anticipation that the price of solar will come down, but that sort of remains to be seen. It is currently in our resource plan. So then, you know, really the challenge that we see with utility-scale solar is the price. The price is above some other alternatives, though they're not, as I said, completely comparable. But we're hoping to see that price come down. And so that's one of the challenges that we see going forward with utility-scale solar. Moving to the next column is the rooftop solar. And here the pricing gets a little bit complicated and possibly even controversial, though I've tried to accurately reflect it. First of all, you need to understand, as I think others have testified, that that this energy comes on our system as a net metered system. Mr. Eloff did a good job explaining the value of solar, which was an alternative tariff. I think he also explained that no utility so far has chosen it. It's a utility election to go with the value of solar tariff versus net metering. I think all the utilities, including us, have chosen to stick with the net metering model for the rooftop solar. Now, because it goes on individuals' homes and businesses, and the energy is used by those customers in their home and business, it's a little hard to talk about what the price or the price impact on our customers is. What I've tried to do here is reflect two elements of the cost of net metered solar. One being the incentive or subsidy programs that are provided to that generation, and the other being the cost shift that we've heard so much about over the last couple of hearings in the committee. The range in sizes is a range that's caused by the fact that not all of our customers pay the same rate. We have different rates for commercial industrial customers, different rates for residential customers, different rates for small business customers. And so the range really falls into the is determined by the amount of, or by the size of the customer and the type of customer that we're serving. As I think Mr. Eloff mentioned, our solar rewards program is paid for by Xcel Energy, by Xcel Energy customers. It's about 8 cents or $80 a megawatt hour, 8 cents a kilowatt hour. And adding that to the cost shift is where I got the numbers that are on there. As I said, other people may have different ways of calculating that, though I think it's probably a pretty fair estimation. And it makes sense, of course. It's going to be more expensive to put solar on people's rooftops. It's going to be less efficient because of trees and buildings and the house doesn't point in exactly the right direction and all that sort of thing. So it would make sense that utility-scale solar, which you can put up in wide open spaces, put on a tracking system and other kinds of things that Ms. Engelking talked about, you know, it makes sense that the rooftop solar would be more expensive to our customers. The Made in Minnesota program is an incentive program that's actually administered by the Department of Energy Resources. They put together that incentive program. Mr. Eloff mentioned it ranges in amount from, I think, $130 to $390 a megawatt hour as an incentive for the Made in Minnesota program. So how much of those kinds of resources are we going to acquire on our system at Xcel Energy? It's limited by the fact that those incentive programs are paid for out of dedicated funds. $5 million a year is
is by law devoted to the solar rewards program. So that $80 per megawatt hour incentive program is limited to $5 million a year, and that's how much we will get. The Made in Minnesota program is $15 million a year. As I think was indicated, not all of that money comes from Xcel Energy customers, but the fact is about 95% of it does, and that's just because, one, we're the biggest conservation program in the state, and two, the balance is made up from our renewable development fund, which comes from our customers. So those are the those are sort of the caps or the limits, you might say, on how much of the rooftop solar is going to be acquired, at least in the current time period. The challenges with rooftop solar, you've already heard about. One, the price is high. We want those prices to come down. The good news is that our customers are exposed to less of that high price because the incentive programs are limited. And the other challenge is the cost shift, which you've probably heard about until you don't want to hear about it anymore, so I won't talk about it anymore. But that cost shift, I think the point that Representative Hortman was making, at low levels of penetration, the cost shift is hard to calculate. It's a tiny little amount on our other customers' bills. But our concern and the challenge that we have is, as that resource grows and as more and more people put rooftop solar on their homes and businesses, if that's what happens, then that cost shift could actually become significant, as Mr. Johnson was talking about with the co-ops. So we think it's important early on to get the rules right, because it's going to be hard to sort of change the rules after a lot of people have gotten invested in this. So that's an ongoing concern, not an immediate concern, because the penetration of the rooftop solar is still pretty modest. And so then we come to community solar, and this is the brand new program. We've got more challenges here, as you can see on the chart, but then that's to be expected. It's a new program. We've never done it before. The law was passed in 2013 and is only now being implemented through the Public Utilities Commission. So the community solar is not net metered. The community solar is what we call a buy-all, sell-all proposition. So what happens is, if a customer subscribes to a community solar garden, we continue to meter their energy use just like we did before they subscribed. And we measure each kilowatt hour that they use in their home or business, and we send them a bill at the same rate that we billed them for before. So nothing changes. They continue to buy all of their energy from Xcel Energy at the same rate. That helps eliminate the cost, or that actually eliminates the cost shift, because, of course, those customers are paying the entire blended rate, including the fixed costs. And they're paying it in real time as they receive those bills from Xcel Energy. And then the other side of that buy-all, sell-all is the sell-all. They own a share of a community solar garden. They have subscribed to a share. I shouldn't say own. They have subscribed to a share of a community solar garden. And we meter all the energy that comes off of their share, and we purchase that energy from them. So that's the buy-all, sell-all part of this proposition. They buy all of their energy from us that they use in their home or business. They sell all the energy to us that they produce in their subscription to the solar garden. And the price for that subscription, or the price of that energy that they sell to us, is set by the Public Utilities Commission. It's between, in my corrected numbers, $114 to $150 a megawatt hour, depending, again, on what kind of customer it is, a business customer, or a residential customer, a small business, large business, and that sort of thing. So, and the way we purchase that is essentially to give them a credit on their bill. So, as I said, we measure the amount of energy they're using at their home or business, and calculate a monthly bill just like we did before, and then we find out how much energy their share of the solar garden produced, and we calculate it using the rates shown here, and we give them a credit on the bill. So that's the way that works. So essentially, our customers, because then that credit that we credit to their bill, we pass through to our customers through our fuel clause. So that's dollar for dollar. It's not marked up. There's nothing else to it. It's just, if we pay them $114, we pass $114 through to our customers. And that program is, as noted here, an unlimited program. So there's no cap on that. There's no spending limit on that. We take as much of the solar garden proposals as come in and as qualify and make it through the process to become an actual solar garden. So this presents us with some new challenges, and maybe I should say before I start going through them that, you know, there is an ongoing docket with the Public Utilities Commission that's looking at the community solar program. Today we filed some comments with the Public Utilities Commission in that docket to look at some of these challenges, to bring some of these challenges to their attention, and of course all the other parties who are interested in this will be able to file comments as well, and the Public Utilities Commission will have to sort through some of these and see if they want to do anything about it. So let me just go quickly through the challenges, and then I'll be happy to answer some questions if you have any. First of all, the unlimited nature of the program makes it impossible for us to limit the exposure of our customers to the prices that we're paying. So as you see, you know, for example, in the rooftop solar, we are paying some high price for that energy as well, but it's limited by the amount of subsidy that's available to pay the incentive. That doesn't exist in the community solar, so there's a little bit of nervousness about, well, how much of this stuff are we going to have to take at what is still a relatively high price for energy. When we opened the program a few weeks ago, we were expecting about 25 megawatts of proposals. I've heard other people who were expecting maybe 50 megawatts of proposals. We got 431 megawatts of proposals in the program. Now, as I talk through this further, you'll understand not necessarily all of those programs are going to get built, but it was disconcerting to think that our customers might be exposed to that much of this energy, which is, you know, frankly a little more expensive than similar solar energy that we could get. So that's one challenge. The second challenge that we had is, while the law requires that solar gardens be limited to 1 megawatt in size, something I learned as you work in this process, and those of you that have been here a while realize, it's kind of hard to put words in statutes and, you know exactly how they're going to be interpreted. So the question came up to the Public Utilities Commission, I'm told, I wasn't there, well, what if somebody builds a 1 megawatt project and then another 1 megawatt project right next to it? So it looks like a 2 megawatt project, but it's because they're right next to each other, but we can call them 2 1-megawatt projects. And the solar, and the PUC said, well, you know, the adjacent projects, you know, we're gonna allow that. I think what they maybe didn't expect, certainly what we didn't expect, is that almost, well, I should say 94% of the 431 megawatts that were proposed to us are projects that are adjacent to one another. One of them is 40 megawatts. Another one is 30 megawatts. A couple of them are 20 megawatts. And so the concern is that if you're able to aggregate all of those together, it starts to look a lot like utility scale solar. And as you can see on the chart, the price of utility scale solar is like $75 to $100, not $114 to $150. And so the challenge for the PUC that we've sort of presented to the PUC, they get all this stuff dumped on them, I guess, is what do you think about that? I mean, you set a price thinking these were kind of 1 megawatt small community scale projects, and what we ended up with is 40 megawatt projects largely out in the country that look an awful lot like the utility scale projects. And so we've asked the PUC to take a look at that and see if we can help address that challenge. The next challenge, number 4, that I've shown on the list, and this is really more anecdotal, but what we seem to be seeing is that larger commercial and industrial customers are the ideal subscriber, especially if you're building one of these very large solar gardens. And that's not hard to figure out. If you had to administer a program with 200 residential subscribers, you know, there'd be costs and people move away and people don't pay their bills and, you know, you've got all kinds of things you have to deal with. But if you can sign up 5 big corporations as subscribers, it's a lot easier. And so, again, we expected business and commercial industrial customers would be able to participate in solar gardens. But if the anecdotal information is true that this is being largely marketed to those folks, you run the risk of really buying pretty expensive energy from commercial and industrial customers, which is being paid for largely by residential customers. And so we've asked the PUC to take a look at that. And then finally, this is a complicated subject, and you will get past my depth very quickly on this. But we're running into some interconnection questions. Each of these solar gardens need to be connected to a substation. If a solar garden is 1 megawatt, you know, the substation, most of our substations can take that. There may be some issues. But if a solar garden is 40 megawatts and you're trying to connect that into a substation that doesn't have room for 40 megawatts, you either start implicating the transmission grid, in which case we get into FERC jurisdiction, and that opens a whole can of worms, or you start having to spend money to upgrade substations to accommodate the solar gardens. And that was not something, because we didn't anticipate the size of some of these gardens, we also didn't anticipate, well, what are you going to do if you start overwhelming substations? Who should pay for the upgrade to the substations that occur because of this? So, again, this community solar program is a new program. It was designed in 2013. We participated in that. I think we've run into some unexpected challenges with that, some unintended consequences. It's in the hands of the Public Utilities Commission, at least at this point, to try to help us sort through all of those. And I guess I'd say stay tuned. We'll see how it all works out.
Thank you very much, Mr. Evans. Representative Portman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, in the community solar situation where you have those 431 megawatts of applications, in what situations do you get to say no? Is it if the project doesn't, if their financing doesn't hold up, if the interconnection doesn't work? In what? So how do you figure that the sorting will happen with those projects? I'm sure some of them ultimately won't. You will get to, as a company, say, no, that doesn't work. And what are those kind of situations?
Mr. Chair, you know, the first thing that happened, of course, is there's a fairly extensive application process that they go through. And I think of the 431, about 100 megawatts were returned to the applicant saying, you know, there's something wrong with your application. Those are likely to be fixed and just sent back, but you never know. Some people might, you know, there might be some problems. Certainly, if they couldn't finance the construction of their system, it won't get built. That wouldn't be a choice we make. That'll just be the fact that if you can't build it, you can't build it, and then we won't buy it. So I think that'll be a problem. I'm not sure exactly. It's really not our program, and it's not really a regulated program, how they sign up subscribers. So I don't know what their situation would be with subscribers if for some reason they weren't able to perform. But that, you know, we haven't encountered that yet. There is a pretty significant cash deposit that is required with your application. I think it's $100,000. It's refundable. You will get it back. Even if you build the system, you'll get it back. It's just there to prove that you have the financial wherewithal to build the project. $100,000 won't build the project, but it certainly shows that you've got some financial backing. So, but obviously, if you can't afford to build it, you won't build it. The interconnection is a real problem. I mean, that could be a problem. A lot of these proposals came in, you know, in the same location. Guess what? Solar developers looked around and they all started looking at some of the same pieces of property, or very closely adjacent properties. And so, the interconnection problem, you know, may be the one that really weeds some people out, particularly, you know, it. I guess from our point of view, I don't think we would ask our customers necessarily to upgrade the substation. And so then it's, well, which of the developers are going to pay? And if that throws your financials off, then that's a problem. So I think probably that's going to be the, you know, one of the tests is just how much room do we have on our system for all of these systems that are being proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Representative Horvin.
Thank you. Just to follow up, when will we know which ones are going forward and when will they start to get built?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. It's an ongoing process. I mean, we're processing the applications. I know we haven't processed all of them. And then there's an engineering study that needs to be done by us to see, you know, what's going to be required in order to get the systems hooked up. And then, you know, the ongoing process with the Public Utilities Commission, where we're essentially asking them to help us sort through some of these challenges and figure out how to deal with them. So I'm afraid I can't really tell you. I expect, you know, it'll take, you know, a year or two before, you know, all of this gets sorted out. And, of course, in the meantime, others can still propose, so there may be more projects coming along.
Mr. Chair, I think this is my last question. Two questions. You don't mean a year or two until the first community solar project gets constructed in Minnesota.
No, I don't, Mr. Chair. No, I don't think I meant that. I think I meant just before we sort through all of these 431 and figure out how it's all going to work.
And then my last question. Portman. So on the linking issue, is that the subject of some ongoing dispute resolution process at the PUC, or has that been finally decided and Excel is either determined not to appeal that determination, or is that still, you know, in the process of maybe going to an administrative law judge or some other proceeding at the PUC?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Portman, I don't know. I mean, it's very new. We don't really know. I know there was discussion early on when the program was put together about adjacent projects. I don't think anybody was contemplating 40 megawatts of adjacent 1-megawatt projects. And so that's going to be a challenge to go through. I don't know the answer. You know, and you can realize, I mean, this is sort of a legislative drafting problem when you think about it. Well, what are you going to say? They have to be a mile apart? You know, well, that may not be fair. Maybe they don't need to be a mile apart. Are you going to have to say they can't be on the same piece of property? Well, what if it's two different? You know, so it just gets hard to say, well, we wanted these to be small, relatively small, 1-megawatt community solar projects, and this is what we got. How are we going to sort that through? I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans, if you could just find out from HQ where that is in the process at the PUC. I'd just be really interested to know that adjacent community solar project question where, you know, we're legislators. We don't necessarily understand all the ins and outs of how dockets proceed at the PUC, but if you can find out and convert it to plain English of where we are, if the appeal's been done or there's still some dispute going on and levels of appeal left to go through, I think that'd be helpful.
I will try to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I'm just curious about the land again. You had come in, or Excel had come in before with your development plan, and I believe you said there was about 2,200 megawatts of solar in your plans moving forward, and that was going to be needing about 11,000 acres. But when Betsy Engel had come down from Geronimo Energy, who you're buying energy from, she gave us the figure of approximately 10 acres per megawatt, or you know, about 1,000 acres for the 100-megawatt project that she's got for the Aurora project. So those numbers kind of don't match. So I'm just wondering if maybe, if you don't know now, but maybe if you bring back something that's a little bit, you know, how did you arrive at 11,000 acres when, you know, if I do the math that she just gave me and she's the developer that's selling you energy, that's more like 22,000 acres, not 11,000 acres. I wonder if you could just help us understand the difference.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, I think we did the math sitting right here with this group of people. So I'll have to do, I mean, we sort of think in terms of 7 acres for a megawatt, which I think is consistent with what Ms. Engelking said. So, but, you know, every system is going to be different. We won't know till it's built, you know, depending on what's in the way and what you have to work around and, you know, what other rules or regulations or zoning laws or whatever. So, you know, I think if I come back, what I'll come back with and say it's about 7 acres a megawatt on average. And if it's 2,200 megawatts, you know, times seven, that's the number.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Yeah, because I was just, you know, I've got three in Wright County, and I got to see the very detailed plan in one of them that's right next to my home. And, you know, we're talking about different bearings of buffer zones and fences and all of that. So you think 7 is closer than 10? 7 is the number that you went with, not 10?
I think 7 is closer to the number. But, I mean, I'll talk to our folks and get back to you and see if there's a better range that they can maybe give you. But that's kind of what they've told me in the past is, you know, 7 to 8 acres per megawatt for solar. But again, it's going to depend on, you know, where the trees are, where the hills are, where the, you know, a whole bunch of other factors. So I'm sure that's why some will take 10 acres to get a megawatt. I imagine that's true, just depending on the sort of the lay of the land.
Thank you. We've got one further question from Representative Neuberger. And then we'll wrap things up at 8 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Evans, as I sit here and I listen, and we've had discussions ongoing about the community solar program, and And I'm just, I guess the way that this is all kind of unfolding, what was originally intended to be small community solar gardens seems to be turning into something unintended, more like a corporate solar garden. It seems to be that's kind of Frankenstein's monster that seems to be trying to come out here and expose itself. I just, if we're going from 1 megawatt little, you know, power your half your neighborhood type of concepts to 40 megawatt corporate loopholes, I would encourage us to explore that further, and hopefully we can get our heads around this.
Thank you, Representative. And again, I want to thank you, Mr. Evans, for coming tonight, and thank all the testifiers for sticking around late this evening. I want to remind the committee that we have a meeting tomorrow, 12:45 in room 10. We'll see you all then, and this meeting is adjourned.